trying to remember.
Because I'm down, I'm really short volunteers. I'm going to write, I'll send an email.
Good evening. And welcome to the April 24th meeting of the San Luis Coastal Unified School District Board of Trustees. The board did meet in closed session, and we discussed, discussed item A, which was a waiver of student expulsion hearing and a stipulated expulsion order. I'm going to go ahead and read a statement. The board has ratified a settlement agreement resolving a dispute concerning the special education and related services made available. No, this isn't the right thing, is it, Doc? Sorry, John. Okay. Then let's just try it this way. The board voted 5-0 to accept the waiver of the expulsion hearing and the stipulated expulsion order.
Perfect.
There we go. The board did discuss the status of negotiations with the Management Educators Council and the San Luis Coastal Teachers Association. The board did not discuss the superintendent's evaluation other than to ask that a special closed session be scheduled, and Mrs. Holmes, you'll be getting information on that. I'd like to get a consensus on the order of business, and I'm going to ask that we move the consent agenda to the first item after presentations, because I think there are people that would like to speak on an item or items on the consent agenda, and this would give them an opportunity to do so.
Oh, that's the PE.
Yeah. So let's move on forward. Is that acceptable to the board that we move the consent agenda? So we'll move that after the presentations and before correspondence and before public comment. So moving forward, do we have a motion on the approval of our minutes?
I make a motion to approve the minutes from the last meeting.
Okay, it's been moved by Mr. Spadafore and seconded by Mr. Buckman. All in any discussion?
Yes, Mr. President. Yes. I'm not going to vote on the minutes because I was unable to attend the meeting. I just wanted to take this opportunity to thank...
7-0. Okay, let's move forward then to a presentation by the Santa Lucia Regional Occupation Program. Dr. Valentine.
Well, I'd just like to welcome Jim Souza here, who will be presenting for the board an overview of the Santa Lucia Regional Occupational Program. And, Jim, I'll just let you introduce the item and proceed.
Thank you, Dr. Valentine. Members of the board.
All right. For some of you tonight, this will be an update on the status of the San Lucia ROP. For the newer board members, it'll be kind of an introduction, possibly, to the ROP if you're not as familiar with it as others. As some of you are aware, the ROP consists of 7-member districts in the county. We're a JPA, Joint Powers Agreement, between 7-member districts. And we serve a total of 9 high schools. And what I like to do, if you take a look at the map there, is if you start in Shandon and you draw a line over to Cambria and then down to Napomo and then back to Shandon, within that triangle are the members of the San Lucia ROP, the 9 high schools, the 7 districts and the 9 high schools that comprise the ROP. We serve almost 3,000 students countywide. A number of ROPs in the state are county-operated programs. They have a director at the county office. They're governed by the County Board of Education. Our ROP is a JPA. Like I said, we're governed by our own school board. Mr. Buckman's your member, and Mr. Millar is your alternate. So those are the two folks that represent you at the ROP Board of Trustees. Moving along here, first item I'd like to talk about is budget and finance. And I know you're not used to an educator saying this, but the governor and the legislature have been very, very supportive of ROP for the past 2 or 3 years. We've received, let me put it in context. 3 years ago, and Russell might remember this, 3 years ago we were threatened with 12% cuts mid-year. So they were actually going to take money back that they had already given us in 2003-04. And since that time, we've actually received growth ADA in the ROP of 28 ADA. And we've received, and the reason that's important is because the ROP is funded, we're funded on a cap basis. We're only allowed funding on a certain amount of ADA. We have a cap. It's about 645 right now. If we generate ADA above that cap, we don't receive any additional funding. Unless a district or unless an ROP leaves money on the table, we might receive a little bit. But so we're funded on with a cap. So any districts in the county have different salary scales, but they're, you know, as each district gives increases to their teachers, it's important we get that COLA so we can keep up. This year in the governor's budget was CTE equipment grant funding, and the ROP itself received a little over almost $85,000, and San Luis Coastal shared in some of that. I'm going to say, I don't know the exact number, probably $15,000 to $20,000. Plus, you received your own allocation for your district. So you're able to kind of double dip, as all the districts were, and receive a little bit from ROP, plus your own allocation, able to generate some funds for equipment in your CTE programs. And then Proposition 1D, which isn't directly related to ROP, but that was a facilities bond that was passed by the voters last fall, and there was a $500 million set-aside in there for CTE facilities. So based on where we were 3 years ago and where we are today, you can see a real real support for ROP and CTE in the budget. So I'm very pleased about that. I know ROP people statewide are. Just real quickly, in terms of funding trends, I mentioned the cap. The yellow bars here year to year show what our cap has been for the last 5 or 6 years. And then if you look at this is for the whole ROP, for the entire JPA. And then the blue bars indicate are actually what we earn. So we've been above our cap consistently. In fact, we had a real upswing from 03-04 to 05-06, and we're kind of leveling off right now, I think, after that upswing. And you'll see a similar situation in San Luis Coastal. Some real growth from 02-03 to 04-05, and then a little bit of a leveling off, or maybe even a little bit of a dip. But I think after all that growth, it's just natural that you've backed off. And you're not the only district in the county that's experiencing this. There are other districts as well. Yes, Walt.
Jim, just so I understand the relationship between funded and earned, is the earned ADA you've served that's above the funded cap that you were talking about, funding cap?
The earned is what your district generates in terms of enrollment. That's the total you generate in terms of your ROP enrollment. Your funded, the purple bar, if it's purple or whatever it is, whatever color that is.
The shorter one.
The shorter one is where you're funded at. So you've been above your cap. Each district, that's a great question.
Okay.
Each district has their own individual cap. And the funding system, the way it's set up in the JPA board regulations, is that if a district falls below their cap, they lose that funding to other districts. So each district, on top of the ROP having to stay above their cap, each district is motivated to stay above their caps. You want to offer a good variety of programs. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But you want as many students as possible in those classes. So your overhead is lower and your ADA is higher because you have higher enrollment but less overhead because you're paying less teacher sections. So smaller class sizes, although have benefit, you don't want, you know, huge classes based on different situations, but you want, you know, decent class sizes to keep your ADA up and keep your overhead low. Purely from a business perspective, that's how I would look at it. Does that make sense, Ed? Yeah. Okay. And that can be difficult to do, too, sometimes. Let's see. All right. We'll talk about curriculum a little bit. Our curriculum, generally speaking, is driven by teachers and advisory committees. If a teacher wants to develop a new course, they virtually check with me, and as long as it's a satisfactory course or would work in the ROP, a teacher or a group of teachers in the countywide would get together and write the course. Then they would take that to an advisory committee for approval, and then it goes on to the steering committee and the board for approval. The beauty of that is we can keep up to date with technology, with the labor market, with trends over the years, because we can drop courses that no longer meet our needs. We can add new courses that do based on new industries, new emerging industries. So ROP has a real advantage in terms of curriculum, being able to do that fairly quickly. So that's a real advantage for us. Also, our advisory committees meet annually, and during that time, they update the curriculum in our courses, or they give us input on updating our curriculum, so we're able to, again, keep up with industry trends and standards. So that's a very critical piece for ROP. That's the biggest piece of our course development and curriculum right there, or mainly our advisory committees. Over the last couple of years, we've implemented a few new courses: animal science, healthcare careers field experience, intro to culinary arts, sports medicine, and veterinary science. And these courses are now being taught in our schools and are available really to be taught in any school. You know, it depends on your situation, whether or not you want to teach them, and your mainly your staffing and your site leadership. And then CTE standards are fairly new. The framework is right now at the print shop for the new CTE standards. And what I think is going to happen, it really hasn't happened yet, but I think in the next year or two, you're going to see a real push statewide to align courses with the new CTE standards. And you're going to see that in San Luis Obispo counties also. We're probably going to have joint workshops across the county, possibly courses. That may be a bit of a challenge. Mr. Unger?
Do you see at some point, if you're moving toward the CTE standards, eventually being able to offer some form of A to G credits for ROP programs?
Actually, we do have, let me go back real quick. Great question. Oops. Oh, I'm on the right slide. This is perfect. Actually, we do have a number of courses that meet A to G standards. Animal science and vet science, both of these courses do. And in fact, at our last board meeting, Mr. Buckman asked me to check on intro to sports medicine as a possible candidate for A to G. And it is offered in a couple of districts, a couple of ROPs in the state, A to G. So we do have probably 20-25% of our courses meet A to G requirements. And we even have a sign language class that meets foreign language requirements, and it's being taught at Templeton right now. And then we have a variety of others. Electronic media meets visual performing arts, A to G standards. So I think you'll see more of a push in that direction. Some of the barriers that existed between ROP and the UC system have come down, so we're making progress there. Yeah, that's true. Okay. This is, actually, I couldn't fit them all on one list, but I have two lists of the courses you're offering currently in your district. And what you'll see is a real variety of courses from agriculture to technology, automotive technology, computer technology, child development, careers with children. If we go on here, electronic media, a lot of ag classes, a lot of technology, a web page, and the teaching careers classes. So really a good variety. Because you have two campuses and different staffing and different needs at each campus, you're able to offer more of a variety of programs or classes than other districts. Even a district like Paso Robles that has a large high school doesn't offer the variety of courses you do. So I think it's because of your flexibility with two campuses and teachers and the staffing at those campuses, you're able to offer quite a variety and a good cross-section of courses for your students. And then student activities. You're probably familiar with all of these. FFA, FHA HERO, which is the Home Economics or Consumer Family Science student organization. I'll come back to Skills USA in a second. Virtual Enterprise is a business course where students create their own business. And HITAC is an automotive competition hosted to go to Kansas City for the Nationals in June. So
actually, it's the second year in a row because Jason Dornish from Morrilby High School won one last year.
Oh, he did? Oh,
went
sorry.
Went to Kansas, yeah.
I was so excited. This was the first year. I forgot about that.
He went on the Nationals.
Jason went on to Nationals, and I think he finished in the top 10 in the Nationals.
Yeah. Oh, I apologize. I was so excited driving here. I was thinking about Skills USA. I can't wait to tell them. It's their first time ever. I forgot about that.
It's good. We're excited. We love it.
No, I know.
So thank you.
No, thank you. Thank you for your support of Skills USA and everything. It's the students are really getting a lot out of it. It's really good. Last thing are challenges. You know, you look at budget, and I just told you a lot of good things about the budget. But with a good budget, that leads to a challenge of program expansion. And program expansion is a challenge because we need facilities and we need qualified and credentialed teachers. So even though the budget is favorable, it does lead to the major challenge I think we're going to face in the next 5 years or so is finding qualified, credentialed teachers to teach our classes. Not just because of expansion, but because of retirement, attrition, et cetera. The universities aren't preparing teachers to teach CTE classes, other than agriculture. And having Cal Poly in our backyard is a big plus. But outside of agriculture, very few universities prepare teachers in business, industrial technology, consumer and family science. So we're looking at a real void there, which we can take up with industry people. We can take people out of industry and get them designated subject credentials, and they can teach ROP. But the problem with that is for example, let's say Jeff Limkuhl resigned, heaven forbid, in June. And you found someone who was willing to teach his class out of industry. That person might look at you and say, well, this is what you're going to pay me to do this, yet I can make more in my shop. And I have to go through all these hoops to get a credential and take these classes to learn how to teach, the teacher preparation courses. That's all, you know, a lot of red tape and bureaucracy and expense, yet I can make more in my shop and you want me to teach high school students. And I'm just, you know, that's one scenario, but it's the reality that we're going to face a real crunch in CTE and ROP for qualified credential teachers. They're trying to streamline this, the situation, to try to get people out of industry easier and make it a little more user-friendly, but you know how the state and the CTE work. It takes forever sometimes to get things accomplished, but at least we're starting to look in that direction.
Mr. Sousa?
Yes.
There's always going to be dedicated people who want to work with kids, don't you think?
I mean, oh, yeah. Continue to make a living, I guess, unfortunately. See, that is all I have, unless there are any questions from the board or the audience or staff.
Well, I don't really have a question. I just wanted to provide some feedback on ROP and how it makes a difference in students' lives. My son, Gordon, who's 19, just was employed by a high-tech carbon fabricating firm over here that does remotely controlled vehicles for various military purposes, and the reason that he was considered and hired for the job, one of them besides his charm and wit, is that he had the CAD, the computer-aided design drafting. He had participated in Skills USA, I think 3 years, but at least two. It's the only thing I'd ever seen that got him up at 5 o'clock in the morning for a bus ride to Bakersfield. He is living on his own and doing really well. But this job was actually a difference for a living wage and a job that involves experience that will build on his resume and help him in the future. And it was really the teachers in the ROP program that lit the fire and got him interested. And then he ended up leaving high school with skills, employable skills, and I attribute it to the program. And I just wanted to let the folks out there know it works.
Right. Thank you. That's true. Okay.
If I can, as the newest board member, but as a member of the ROP board, what I've seen so far at the meetings is this incredible dedication to the children and giving them alternatives. Sorry about that. And giving them alternatives to the everyday classes and giving them career skills. And it's why I volunteered to do it, and I'm seeing it, and I'm very excited about it.
Great. Thank you, Mark.
Yes, I think no high school would be a great high school without ROP. It just fills it out and makes it multidimensional and quality, and it's wonderful.
Right.
Thanks for moving out of your office so my classroom could be in there.
Yeah, Adrian and I have a special relationship. I was homeless for a while because she needed my office. So, yeah.
Have some cookies, Jim.
Yeah, I'll grab a couple on the way up.
Hey, any other questions from board members? Great. Thank you very much.
Right,
we really appreciate it.
This
was very interesting. And we'll next move on to the Safe Routes to School. Kirk Collins is here, and I guess you're going to be assisted by Rod Hoadley.
Yes. Found out as the day went along, we really felt like Hawthorne wanted to give this a shot. And Rod Hoadley is here with me. He's an engineering professor at Cal Poly, a parent at my school, a bicycle crazy person, and also I think he's CEO of Peak Racks, and he puts all these really cool bicycle racks around our campuses, Cal Poly, the high school. We have them at Hawthorne. And as we started looking at this, we found out that there are a lot of key parts that really make sense. And for a community school where, you know, you have kids who do have the ability to walk or ride a bike or use a scooter, it really makes a lot of sense. And so we really felt like you know, using Hawthorne as kind of the guinea pig, hopefully, for the rest of the district, you know, might be a good thing. And so, anyway, I met up with Rod because I knew that he was totally into bicycling, and I see him riding along with his wife to school every day, riding their kids on their bikes, and I know that he is very involved. So we started talking about safe routes to schools. And he just took the bull by the horn, started getting all these different groups within San Luis Obispo involved and setting it up. We even have the garbage company involved, and they're going to allow us to put our Safe Routes to School stickers on all their trash cans, so when they roll out, all the people driving around will see all these stickers. And starting May 11th and for the next five Fridays, we're going to have, we feel, lots and lots of kids participating. And so I'm going to turn it over to Rod and let him kind of tell you kind of the nuts and bolts of what's going on.
Okay, thank you. So I have three things up here. Basically, I just want to get across to you what we're doing right now for Safe Routes for Hawthorne, and also just give you some idea about the agencies involved with what we're doing. And then lastly, I want to give you a list of sequence of events that we've gone through to get to where we are right now. So we'll start here with this. I don't know if you guys can see that. Can you guys at the board see that? Okay, basically I have listed up here our basic goals are to promote exercise and minimize traffic at the school area here. And I think this fits in well with a lot of the childhood obesity stuff that's in the news right now. And like Mr. Collins said, it's the last five Fridays of the school year. So we've designated those as official days at Hawthorne School where kids can participate. And I've listed here ways to participate. And we're going to encourage carpools to the school. And then they can walk in together with a group to be like a walking school bus. So those are just the basic ways they're going to participate. Yeah, I want to put that in the second one up there. And so this is just an idea of some of the agencies involved here. And I did forget to put San Luis Garbage Company on there. I'm really glad that Mr. Collins mentioned that because I forgot that. And that's going to be a really big one for us. It was one that I didn't think would happen, but I'm very, very happy. So we have City of San Luis Obispo. People who work for the city are helping us, and they're also giving us funding. San Luis Regional Rideshare, they're working with us and giving us funding for this. San Luis County Air Pollution Control District, again, they're working with us and giving us some grants for this. San Luis Police Department, very active in making this happen and being present when it's happening. The League of American Bicyclists, we have cycling educators come to teach bicycle education to the students at Hawthorne Elementary. We have educators, staff members, and Hawthorne parents helping out also. So those are the agencies that are helping us do this. And some of the activities we have are, we have a bike education class for parents May 2nd. We have a bike education classes for students, for the kids to bring their bicycles and learn about safe cycling. We have safety presentations set up for each classroom at Hawthorne School. And we have an assembly to kick off the whole program, and that's going to be this coming Friday. So I can ask if you guys have any questions. Basically, I just wanted to list what we've done so far. It could be really quickly, but if you want to ask any questions, that's fine. Okay, I'll wait a second here. So just gives you an idea what we've done so far. If other schools want to do this, and that's one of our goals also, is we're hoping that other schools in San Luis Coastal will do this. And basically, it's find a person who is a champion to the school, who's willing to take on the project and make sure things happen. And they meet with the principal, make sure that the principal's on board, and then they get together and establish possible dates for safe routes. Then we define activities that are associated with that, things like the assembly, things like the parent education classes, the student cycling education classes. Then we gather community support, solicit volunteers. Then we start to establish routes, train the route leaders, and then present safety information in the classroom prior to this happening so the students are prepared for this.
Rod, I had a question.
Sure.
Thank you very much for doing this, for volunteering your time and organizing this. Is there any way, have you anticipated having the students at the end of this next session with what is being developed at Hawthorne take this home to their parents and then come back next year with a plan to continue and implement this in different ways where the parents are also involved, and then a view can be developed or a plan can be developed to extend this on a permanent basis rather than just the one time. Have you discussed that?
Do you want me to address that, or do you want to?
One of our hopes by starting this is that parents will see that this is a great thing. Kids are going, we know that kids are behind it already, and they're going to want to do it. And we're hoping that they will become more involved than they already are so that we don't have to just make it a Friday event. We think it's going to trickle into the other days of the week just this year after we start. And one of the things that we're doing is surveying to find out how the participation rate goes up as far as kids that are walking, riding their bikes. And then next year, it would be to get parents to get on board to see that this is going to happen with their children when possible. One of the things that is kind of a drawback is that we do have some people that come from pretty far away. And so what we're trying to make them see is that there are still ways that they can ease up on the congestion, they can participate, and they can become part of our Safe Routes program.
And could the other thing be a possible way to recognize students who take leadership roles in encouraging other students and encouraging the parents to become involved in terms of recognizing student leaders and students who become more involved with that?
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's great. Any other questions?
And speaking of recognition, this is impressive how much work you've put into this and how much collaboration is you have helped to develop. It's just amazing. It's exciting.
I would just like to say on behalf of the board, we appreciate the efforts that you have made at Hawthorne School. One of the things that you're probably aware of is, as we discussed the redistricting of the various elementary schools, we had a strong interest in safe routes for students to be able to get to a school and home from school, and this seems like a great first step. So we just wanted to thank you very much and hope that some of the things that you're talking to the California Healthy Kids survey presentation. We have Dana Francis, one of our counselors, and Frank Warren from Drug and Alcohol Prevention. And we have Bill Gates here this evening.
In spirit. Spirit of royalty, actually.
Good evening, President Unger and board members. It's a pleasure to share with you our presentation tonight, and I'll be partnering with Frank Warren from Drug and Alcohol. I asked him about the title of the presentation, and he reminded me of something of which I'm very proud, that our school district has been building assets for our youth for over 7 years, and as we share with you the data of the California Healthy Kids Survey, you'll learn more about how that correlates with keeping the numbers down. And when we end, we can all look at steps we can continue to take so that our school district is a healthy community where teachers can teach and students can learn. Oh, yes, I don't want you to miss a word. In October of 2005, our entire district participated in administering the California Healthy Kids Survey. As required by the state of California, we have to have active permission for fifth grade parents. They're aware of the questions, they actively give their written consent, and as with all of the surveys, there's a high degree of confidentiality. It's anonymous, so no identifying information is available, just the data. But we wanted to look at how many of our 5th, 7th, 9th, and 11th graders participated. We had high returns for 5th, 7th, and 9th in the 80s and the 70%. We did notice that our 11th graders, there's only 65% who agreed to participate. However, it's still significant. Okay. Other districts have gone to passive participation. That might be something the board wants to consider at a future date. There's pros and cons to those methods. The good news is that the major risk indicators are going downward. Trends over time are going in the direction that we want. So alcohol, other drug use, binge drinking is going down. Not surprising that alcohol is the most used drug. It's the most available. Where we actually look better than other areas.
All right. Well, thank you for letting me join you today and talk about what I think is really critical for any school district to discuss, which is their Healthy Kids survey results. I've had the opportunity with San Luis High to spend upwards of almost, I think, 10 hours with the staff in the last couple of years working on how to interpret these results, what do they mean, how do we make changes in the classroom, and the couple districts so far this year have worked with us as well. I think it's critical to point out some of the concerns, but also we're going to show you some of the things that you should be conscious that you're making good strides and differences in. So the first stat you see there is around binge drinking. Binge drinking really is the hot topic for a lot of school folks. It's the thing that gets the most press, and for good reason. It's a very high-risk drinking behavior. And you have to understand, when young people in this survey are asked about binge drinking, they're asked about their binge drinking level at the adult level of binge drinking. When we talk about four drinks for a young woman in a short amount of time or five drinks, that's the same question that they get asked at Cal Poly and other universities, and adults get asked as well. So the alcohol capacity is no different. So the numbers are down. We're still higher than the county at this district, and we're unfortunately a good amount higher than the state. Trend-wise, we are reducing that, and I think there's some reasons for that. We're being active about talking about binge drinking. Two or three years ago, you wouldn't find a school, not just in this district, in this county, or this state, who would actively talk about binge drinking, because to talk about binge drinking implies you have to accept that drinking exists. And schools are getting better about that and understanding how to engage young people around drinking behavior and high-risk behavior. Another one of those high-risk behaviors is young people who show up on campus under the influence. San Luis Coastal is right in there with the county number of 21 to 23% of young people in the high school numbers. Now, I'm not going to focus much on the fifth grade numbers because they're asked very different types of questions in order to make comparisons. But if you would ever want to have those discussions about your fifth grade numbers, we certainly have looked at the data. Alarming for, I think, a number of reasons is that marijuana use increasing by five times between seventh and ninth grade. Part of that is availability. You know, when your environment changes, things become more available or accessible. Part of it is a perception piece that we'll get to as well. Some more concerns include a trend that we're seeing nationally. More young women are reporting drinking on regular levels in people. That's those who report having used alcohol or drugs. Alcohol, very easy to get. Our juniors and freshmen in this district are actually reporting it easier than those peers of theirs at the county level or the state level, including marijuana. 78% of 11th graders in this district say it's very easy to get marijuana, and 24% of the freshmen in this district have been offered illegal drugs, at least by their self-report. That's pretty consistent with county and state numbers as well. I think really important whenever you have these discussions is to remember that there are good things as well. In fact, your 7th grade alcohol use is nearly three times less than the county rate right now. In fact, across the state and in the county, we're seeing somewhat of a dramatic rise in alcohol use at the 7th grade level. Again, trend-wise, it's down. Within the last couple surveys, though, we're starting to see 7th grade alcohol behavior change. Your district, though, is keeping your 7th grade alcohol numbers lower, and I think that's something to point to and try to figure out why so we can keep doing it. Across the state and across this county, there is more alcohol and marijuana use on campus these days than tobacco. That's a significant change in the last 10 years, certainly. Concerning to all of us in the alcohol, drug treatment, and prevention field is perceived harm. That's a key indicator when you're looking at alcohol and drug behavior. How do young people think it will affect them, or will it affect them? In our county, and there's a lot of reasons probably for this, our young people do not see alcohol as harmful as their peers across the state. The danger of those things, you've seen in the newspapers, you've seen probably in board reports, in school reports, they lead to suicide attempts, overdose. All of these things have happened right here in our community and in our county. And so it's a good reason that we keep discussing these things. But let's not forget, a majority of young people don't drink or use drugs. And this is a key thing I'm always telling schools, especially, to keep this at the forefront. When we start saying things like, oh, every kid does it, or everyone's going to drink, we're really lying to the young people. It's not true. We know from survey after survey, statistic after statistic, a strong majority of young people are not getting involved with alcohol or drugs. And I think that's really impressive when you look at your district numbers there. I also think it's interesting to look at perception about their peer use. Young people in San Luis Coastal think 96% of their peers smoke pot. Incredibly destructive, incredibly addictive, very accessible problem. That's increasing. You can say those same things about alcohol. It's destructive, extremely addictive, certainly available, and for the most part, a problem that hasn't gone away. So if you were to ask me the question, then what about our meth problem here in San Luis Coastal? Let me point it out to you. The short bar, as we referred to earlier, is your meth issue. The red big bar is the alcohol issue. And I make this point because I think this is an easy one for people to get lost in. As long as we keep putting alcohol aside as not our issue, we may be missing out on a very big gateway situation, which is as long as we continue normalizing alcohol, we continue to think, oh, everyone's going to do it, so it's okay, we may be missing out on what's really happening with our young people, and that is alcohol is being used at somewhat of a dangerous and alarming rate. There are some very key things that any school district can do to be sure that they stay ahead of the curve, and I think San Luis Coastal does these things very well, especially counseling. Counseling for young people who have identified alcohol or drug problems is not a way of just taking care of them or getting them out of the classroom. Counseling says this is different. You have an issue that needs attention. We care about that issue, which could be an addiction, or it may just be some kind of trial behavior. Either way, counseling is, I think, the strongest response a school can give to when they see that. The other piece is infiltration, and this is something that good schools do very well. It doesn't just come from the health teacher. It doesn't come from the principal. It certainly just doesn't come from the counseling department. When all facets of a school campus are talking about alcohol and drugs in real terms, they're going to have a much better effect on that wide group of young people. And certainly a lot of people here who know me, have worked with schools in the past, know that curriculum is a no-brainer. You can move alcohol and drug issues into any facet of curriculum and really get to young people at the classroom level. We also know, and I'm sure you'll be getting some handouts a little bit later from these Healthy Kids surveys, that where you see schools with lower alcohol or drug issues, you're seeing higher API, you're seeing higher test scores. When you see young people who have higher asset scores, which we're about to address, you're going to see higher test scores as well. The other thing I think San Luis Coastal has done extremely well in the last and now that actually the state requires that schools show an improvement in those scores as well. Key things to look at here when you look at, this is the 9th grade and 11th grade, looking at external assets, or what we would call protective factors. And the three main areas are, do they experience caring relationships? Do they have high expectations both of themselves and placed on them? And do they have meaningful participation? Young people, especially in high school, will always rank feeling like they have meaningful participation at the lowest. And that's certainly true in your district, and it's true across the county, and it's true across the country. Now, if you look at the second set of numbers at the bottom there, that's your in the school domain. Do they feel they have caring relationships, high expectations, and meaningful participation in the school? And it's even lower. And the reason for that, I think a lot of times, is that school becomes very didactic. It becomes very much, teacher to student. And students really do react when they're given an opportunity to create rules, to create environment. And so we certainly like to point to that as well. This slide continues to point out the change between those four environments where they're asked about those external assets. And then the internal assets, those are what we would call the internal other protective factors. Your students rank very high around having good goals and aspirations and self-efficacy, seeing themselves as being a part of the solution. But where they come in ranking the lowest amount of assets is around problem solving. And that's, again, similar to the county and state. Good things for schools to know so they can react and respond. Finally, this all ties together, and there's a number of different scientific methods when you look at assets. Assets are sometimes called the internal assets or external assets. We sometimes use the terms supports and opportunities, positive developmental outcomes. A lot of science, for instance, by Hawkins Catalano, Bonnie Bernard, uses protective factors, resiliency traits. Those are the things that are measured in that. And we know that when those things have improvements is when we start to see a true reduction in alcohol, tobacco, drug use, crime, etc. So all in all, your Healthy Kids Survey is a really great document for you to understand a little bit about what's going on, not just with your young people, but with your school campuses and your communities as well. And we certainly at Drug and Alcohol Services are very grateful to have the opportunity to have the dialogue with your school district when we can.
Programs in place? Are there things that you think we can do as a board or that we can do as a community to try and work on this?
Binge drinking's tricky because, like I said before, parents and schools, in order to talk about binge drinking, which is to reduce the capacity of alcohol that a person takes in, you have to acknowledge that they're drinking to begin with. And typically, we're abstinence-based when we come from the school perspective. And that's, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But in order to address binge drinking, it's a different conversation. So young people who are engaged in that behavior are drinking at a higher rate, sometimes for different reasons. We do know nationally over time that as young people are drinking less and less, those who are doing the drinking are drinking larger and larger capacities and quantities. So in order to truly address it, I think a school needs to have a plan about how they are going to acknowledge that drinking exists and be sure that they're working with parents so that they're not giving mixed messages. You know, schools are afraid to say, you know, have designated drivers and, you know, techniques to keep yourself, you know, safe in those situations. And there is no program that I'm aware of that addresses just binge drinking that schools have been able to embrace because of those issues.
If I can just follow up. It always struck me as strange that we spend all school year talking through DARE, talking through other programs about the dangers of drug and alcohol. And then the major event of the summer is the Mid-State Fairgrounds, where we have seen just an incredible increase in the number of booths where there was a beer garden that you had a drink in the beer garden, then beer was open, and now it's Cuervo Go, and it's every other booth. And it just seems strange message that we send as a community that all year we're telling you don't need to use alcohol or drugs to have fun, and then the very first large event of the summer where we send a lot of our children is the message we're sending is you have to have alcohol to have fun.
Yeah. Well, you're exactly right. One of the ways we've addressed that with young people in our county is engage them in environmental prevention strategies where they're actually the ones who go with us and help us test to make sure that the people selling the alcohol are not selling to minors. We took two San Luis High students last year to the opening night of the fair. I'm not going to quote the numbers because I don't want to be wrong, but we popped more than we thought we would on that first night, came back, the young people help us give the training. So there are young people engaged in that because you're exactly right. To walk into those fairgrounds, which is really no different than turning on the television,
existed or that it was happening.
Right.
And then further discussion with anecdotal stories turned up instances where alcohol was being taken from the home or alcohol was being provided at home.
Yeah. Century Council says 60% of the alcohol comes from home.
And it's provided sometimes by adults who
right.
say, I'd rather have you home drinking
right.
than driving
so,
around, so this is
right.
the lesser of two evils.
Right.
First of all, is there an education component that you've seen in the schools or seen in the community that has started to do two things? Stop the denial that there is actually binge drinking and drinking happening, and the second part, that it's being provided mostly at home, so you don't have the issue about stores selling to underage people, number one. And number two, the connection that we see at the board during expulsion hearings, where deteriorating grades and performance and attendance at school sometimes and often is associated with drug and alcohol
mm-hmm.
abuse, so there's a pattern developing. Mm-hmm. So how much have you seen over the years in terms of parent involvement in education, in terms of school and parents working together with that message that, A, there is something happening, and, B, there are signs that this can be addressed earlier rather than later, and, C, it's a crime for an adult to provide alcohol to a child in that fashion?
Yeah, very true. If I had a nickel for every time a parent said, well, wasn't that school doing their job, and every time the school said, well, those parents are really messing those kids up, I'd be doing pretty well. The issue here is that everyone has a stake in this, and, in fact, I talked with a group of young people last week about, the beer companies like to tell parents, you should be the ones to talk to your kids about alcohol. They don't tell them what to say. They just say, talk to your kids about alcohol. Well, to be honest with you, there's a lot of parents I don't want talking to their kids about alcohol. We want to make sure we're giving real, true information. So program-wise, again, very difficult because it takes getting parents on campus or getting parents together, in any forum. San Luis High, I think, took the greatest leap forward a few years back with Principal Horsey, followed by Principal Jones, has done a remarkable job of engaging parents. We had an assembly two school years ago, last school year, where we knew it was going to be a big issue about alcohol, and the principal said, let's invite parents, which is remarkable. Even to this day, to have parents on school campus during the day to hear those messages. That's a good way to start, is making sure that what the young people are hearing, the adults are hearing as well, so that they can share with each other and support that. There are future opportunities. The social
downtown on St. Patrick's Day, in the middle of the day, there were so many intoxicated youth.
Yeah.
So it's a difficult problem in terms of what they see. But I think that perception, I'm sure there's at the university a lot of kids who are sober all the time and studying, but we don't always hear about them.
No, we don't. And you're right. We do have an oversaturation of alcohol licenses in a very small area. That is another issue that this this town and county is dealing with. The university itself and its willingness to get tougher and more strict around alcohol policies. All these things, need community awareness. And your young people, just so you know, especially those who are involved in our Friday Night Live programs and our prevention programs, are really at the table talking about those policy issues, which are real significant.
Frank, could you do me a favor? I keep forgetting that this is televised and it's repeated. Could you actually give us a definition of binge drinking? Because I think it sounds almost fun.
Yeah, I typically don't use the term binge drinking. That's a Healthy Kids survey. I use the word overdrinking or dangerous drinking. Binge drinking, defined by the Harvard Medical Institute, is for a male, 5 drinks or more in a short amount of time, typically 2 hours. A woman would be 4 drinks in that same amount of time.
So what you're saying is, in our schools, 30% of the students...
11th graders.
Of 11th graders...
Who report drinking.
Are doing the 5 and 2 hours.
Yes. And typically, how that's defined, too, you have to be careful, is those drinks are a standard 12-ounce beer, the 4 ounce, the 6 ounce. So it's the standard drink level. But if you were to see a party, most people who drink are drinking larger capacities. So those 4 drinks may technically be 6, 8, depending on the capacity of the cup, capacity of the actual can or bottle as well.
Thank you.
You bet. Okay.
Well, thank you very, very much. We really appreciate that. And thank you very much, Dana.
Sure.
This is really interesting.
If I could just put one last plug in, it is relay time. So I will be handing you relay packets and obviously hoping that you all join us for relay at the Memorial Day weekend, as always. Right.
Would you like to just tell us briefly, and for the people who would be watching this on television, what the relay is you're talking about?
16th annual 24-hour relay challenge, San Luis High. How San Luis High pays for a great...
So with the board's permission, let's do correspondence, public comment, and then we'll go into the consent agenda. The board did receive correspondence, several pieces of correspondence. We received a parent letter regarding the cost to participate in basketball. We received emails from Jody Evans, Bob Huddle, Mike Aiello, Gary Lamprecht, Don Attias in support of the schedule waiver for PE at San Luis Obispo High School. We received a letter from Ellen Sheffer in support of the scheduled waiver for PE at San Luis Obispo High School. I received a letter from the County Office of Education recommending a positive certification of our second interim financials as submitted. And did receive an email from the Joyce family regarding school safety. And that may be something we want to talk about at advanced agenda items. Let's move on to public comment. We have two people. We actually have, I believe, four public comments, two of which are related to one of the items that would be on the consent agenda. So our first would be Bob Lloyd. Bob?
Good evening. Excuse me. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Bob Lloyd with AGP Video. We had a gentleman who worked with us. His name was Paul Tweed Jr. He worked a lot of the teach telethons. For years, he used to work the school boards. He passed away on Friday due to cancer complications. He did really enjoy working the school board meetings. He's what got me involved in this AGP Video because he and I would communicate, and he'd say, "You got to watch this next meeting." This was when the meetings were televised years and years and years ago in the old building. It was the best television in Slo County at the time, better than Jerry Springer. But anyway, I just want to let you know that he has passed away, and he really did enjoy doing these shows or doing these meetings. Nancy Castle is arranging a memorial service for him on Sunday for the Historical Society from Morro Bay. He also taught a lot of people how to use equipment. He was very involved in the public access television system. They're having a memorial service for him right now as we speak. So anyway, I just wanted to inform the board, inform the public that he had passed, and I'm sorry to hear that.
Thanks very much, Bob.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
I remember him well.
Shall we go to Susan Norris?
Good evening. It is now April, the end of April. I have nothing. And I wanted to let you know about that I did receive a response from them that they would deal with my issues in 3 weeks. I received that in December. They responded 3 months later with a meeting on March the 8th, which they didn't show up for. I also followed up with additional letters with requests of PEEP. I spoke to two staff members of Student Services, and I have not had satisfactory response. They did send a behavioral list. But that person that didn't follow up with his primary school, which is the Laureate. I feel that I've gone now an entire school year since I started working on this in the summer before we ever entered PEEP. I've gone an entire school year, and I've gotten nothing, and I feel that he's missing out on many, many of his educational opportunities that he's entitled to because of these problems. I feel like the point of view that we have taken here in the district is we'll wait until he gets to elementary school, we'll wait till he fails, and then we'll do something for you maybe if we feel like it. I feel sorry for children who don't have parents that work as hard as I've worked, and I seem to be able to navigate the social services being a foster parent, but for whatever reason I can't seem to navigate the school district and getting the services that I need for my child. I wanted to let you know about this because I think it's very sad, and I feel that I'm at a loss and I can't get what I need. My child can't get what he needs, and he's missing out on many things in life, and he's 3 years old now. It's not going to get any better for him if we don't do something about that now, and I don't want to wait till he gets to elementary school to fail. So I did want to let you know that this is happening in your district, and this is happening with somebody who has stuck by it and tried to make it happen, and I have been unsuccessful at it, and I would appreciate any help that I could get. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Norris. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Anybody else from the public who'd like to address the board? Okay. On this public comment, we will also be going straight to consent agenda, and I believe one of the items is going to be pulled. I intend to pull one myself. I think it's an item of interest to most people. So seeing no one else, then let's move on to the action consent agenda. Please let me know if there's anything that anybody would like pulled. Item number 9, approval of certificated and classified personnel items. Number 10 of donations.
Pull that.
15, disposition of surplus property. 16, approval of furniture and equipment requests. 17, approval of purchase orders. 18, approval to participate in community-based English tutoring CBET program for 2007-2008. And item 19, approval of international student exchange program EF Foundation for Foreign Study. Okay.
I have a motion.
Okay. Is there, Mr. Spatafor, would you like to make a motion?
I'd like to make a motion that items 9, 10, 13, 15, 16, 17, 18, and 19 be approved as so stated.
Second.
It's been moved by Mr. Spatafor and seconded by Mr. Millar. Is there any discussion on those items? Anybody from the public that would like to discuss those items? Okay. Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Carries 6-0. Item number 11, approval of supplement for waiver of bilingual tester. Mrs. Dickinson.
I just had it. Well, I'm looking over my board packet this weekend when it was my husband's birthday, so Sabrina came down with her boyfriend, Kevin Coachpapa, whose dad is Thai. So I'm saying, Kevin, don't you have any relatives who speak Thai who would want to come over and, you know, interpret some tests for the school district? So I said, yes, I'll look into it, and some of them speak other languages as well. And I called my friend Tareya Elmirati, who speaks Arabic, and said, you know, you have such a huge community. Maybe somebody wants to interpret some tests. But their questions were, how much time does it take? I mean, what kind of a job is that?
It happens at the Welcome Center, and it depends on the number of students that we need to have tested. It would, in our situation, it would probably be a very small amount of time because it's a very small amount of students.
And it's just like in the spring testing?
It can actually happen whenever somebody comes in and requires testing. So if somebody new came to the district and that's the language that they spoke. But really what this waiver item is about is the only one on here so we do that in Spanish. Obviously, we have a high Spanish population. That's not on here. So we get waivers for the languages in which we have really small representation, and then we don't actually test in that language.
But we look for people who, just in case we want to test in those languages. I mean, there may be people who speak those languages who would want to help.
We do. If you notice on the item, it says each language identified with more than 10 EL students, and the state actually clumps them together, Filipino and Tagalog together, and so the district will be seeking testers in that area.
So it's only if there's 10 students we look for a tester?
Correct.
Oh,
right.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Would you like to make a motion on that?
I make a motion that we approve the waiver request.
Okay, it's been moved by Mrs. Dickinson and seconded by Mr. Buckman. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Carries 6-0. Okay, let's move on then to item number 12, the approval of the general waiver request for the PE requirement. We have two people that would like to address the board on this. Mike Aiello.
My perception of the general waiver request for PE, and I've given you a copy of my comments. The San Luis High faculty and management team was given the mandate by a previous Board of Education to develop a philosophy for our school and develop a schedule that reflected our beliefs. After much time and effort, we decided that the high school should allow a student to complete the UCA through G requirements, as well as have a rich elective program. To facilitate this, we developed the trimester system. At the last Board of Education meeting, you spoke of approving the general waiver request for PE with conditions. Please don't approve this waiver conditionally. Support our school's established program. Under the waiver, PE is not being marginalized. Our annual PE minutes exceed the number of PE minutes required by the State Department of Education. The trimester system has enhanced the current PE program by allowing inclusion of popular electives like dance aerobics, weightlifting, advanced racket sports. In addition, the trimester has flexibility to allow the inclusion of other PE electives based on teacher initiative. The Board of Education imposed conditions would be in conflict with the previous Board of Education's mandate, making us responsible for our own vision and program. The work that has been done over the years by the faculty and management teams needs to be honored. The general waiver request resulted from the district's coordinated compliance review of K-12 PE program. The general waiver, which was recommended by the California Department of Education as the standard solution for schools in California, which have other than the traditional semester schedule. The current report back from the CDE consultant is that we meet the compliance issues, as stated in the high school criteria document accompanying the request. With your approval of this waiver, the last step our district needs to take with this waiver will be completed. The mandate that franchises the SLCTA states that it is to champion the wishes of a majority of the teachers at any site which they represent. In taking their unilateral action to oppose the approval of the general waiver, they have not only shown a complete disrespect for our previous work, but are acting as a rogue agency that has abandoned its founding principle.
Jim Questenberry, Morbay High School teacher, treasurer of the SLCTA, member of the executive board. Referring to the PE waiver for San Luis High School, the association position on the PE waiver was not an attack on the trimester schedule at all. It was not an attempt to micromanage a particular site. We're not attempting to reduce the electric program at San Luis High School. We took our position based on two concerns. Is the current PE program in the best interest of all the students, 9th and 10th graders especially? Is it in the best interest of all our teachers at all of our sites? We heard from teachers at all levels of the district, elementary, middle school, high school. We listened to the district administrators. We reviewed our past concerns, and then we voted. Our rep council meetings are open to our membership. We encourage equal representation from all sites. We welcome constructive criticism. There are some errors and misconceptions in your letters. A letter from one of the members of the San Luis High management team says that there are no San Luis High teachers on our executive board. That is not true. Our vice president is from San Luis High. It also states, Mr. Unger stated, was that all the letters that you have received are in support. Actually, one letter from Bob Huddle says that he encouraged a third trimester of PE, if you'll read that carefully. So I just want to make sure that we're clear on some of these things. And I hope that I've been concise in my comments. I'm sorry.
Thanks very much, Jim. Is there anyone else from the public who'd like to address us on this topic? Mrs. Sheffer.
Thank you. I'll be brief. You have a letter from me in your packet. I'd like to thank Mr. Unger for his reply to that letter. Thank you. The only thing I'd like to do is point out a couple of things on the comments from the SLCTA Executive Board that is on the last page of item number 12 in your packet. The great number of students we have who will be participating in a sport. So I'd like to make sure that everyone is clear on that the workload for the counselors will not be increasing to the extent stated in bullet number 5. Also, again, just to reiterate, the counselors have been involved in and are supportive of the waiver. The very final item, stressing that the executive board views the waiver as a temporary solution, again, I would like to just clarify that the state views this as a solution. There is nothing about it being a temporary solution. It is in place for 2 years, but if we look at that and compare and think again about things like WASC accreditation, that is not a temporary accreditation. It is a process we go through and seek reapproval and work with the state in compliance with the education code. So the state views this as a solution. If the solution that we are setting forth and would like to continue with the monitoring program is successful and works well, and if the management team of the high school as well as the teachers and staff view it as being an acceptable and viable solution, then in 2 years we may again, depending upon what the wishes of the school are, seek this as a solution again. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Is there anybody else that would like to address the board on this item? Please.
Hi, my name is Jerry Ramsey, and I'll keep it very brief. My issue is actually largely about the entire change of PE being required for two trimesters, even if your child is involved in a sport for one, two, or three trimesters. And I know that that's not what you're discussing now. But I have been speaking to a lot of parents whose kids are very involved in academic and athletics. And right now all they're aware of is that it will be two trimesters. I think if they found out that it was going to be three trimesters, there would be a revolt among the parents whose kids are involved in sports. It's already difficult enough to swallow what's going on with two trimesters. So I think three would be just impossible to accept.
Thank you. And you know, we did have this discussion several months ago about whether, in fact, athletics could be considered PE credit. And
a couple things I wanted to possibly correct. I'm the board member at the last meeting that used the word marginalize. And the word marginalize was used in the context that this is a waiver, and by no means is it meant to marginalize the importance of physical education. I support the waiver because I believe that everything I've heard to date indicates that the trimester system at the high school is very important for the majority of students. Marginalization, in my estimation, was only meant to characterize this as not a denigration of the importance of physical education at the school and in a child's life for the obvious reason. So that is just something to correct. The reason I support the waiver is because for me, the only thing that would be important, or one of many things that would be important, I should say, would be the school, that being the teachers and the administrators, coming to the board and saying that here's something different or here's something that we can change that would improve the opportunity for the students in terms of the classes they have available to them. And my comment last time regarding looking at this next year or looking at this in the year after only meant to convey that if it turns out that utilization of class time either as elective or PE needs to be addressed, that we should look at it because there may be a reason to address an issue. There may be a reason to support intramural activities on campus for students who aren't involved in certain athletic events in their junior and senior year. There may be a reason to look at small or limited attendance at certain elective classes that really aren't serving many students anymore. All I meant when I made the comment about marginalizing was that we don't marginalize really two things. We don't marginalize the importance of physical education, which is critical, both at school and at home and in the summer. But we don't marginalize really what this is all about, and that's the students' availability for classes that are meaningful for them in terms of graduating and moving on in life to many, hopefully, fruitful endeavors. So I wanted to correct that. And I do support the waiver, but it's a waiver. It's not like getting an accreditation where you prove that you've done something. This is something to say we really can't meet the standard of the state, and we need a waiver to do this, which is a trimester system that we have. And that's fine. I support that because we have a good system at San Luis High. But that doesn't mean the conversation shouldn't continue to develop other aspects or alternatives that may improve
children and high school students. So I think we should all keep that in mind, that we're looking for what's best for students. And I think if we're all looking for what's best for students in the world we live in now, we're going to be looking at more PE. Now, I think the timing for this year for making a big change is not right, partly because of the of what you're mentioning about the athletic program. I think those parents of kids who play sports are going to realize they'll survive. At Arroyo Grande High School, they've never had PE credit.
for playing sports all these years, and no one seems to think a thing of it. So once they get over that, but the timing would be bad. And I think it would be too abrupt in a way to make a change for next year. But I would be really interested in looking at more PE year after next. And I think the state may move to, put 4 years of PE back eventually. When we look at how many students are significantly overweight. And this district tends to be an elitist district. I teach at Arroyo Grande High School. We're not as elitist. We tend to kind of look at our problems and face up to them. At this district, a lot of parents know this. We think we're kind of better than everyone else, and our kids are not as... I think it's true. We don't really have those problems of obesity and those kind of things. You're all saying no, but I've heard this from parents out there in the community. We need to address, activity for high school kids in this district. And I'm glad that there's all these creative ways like dance and weightlifting and racket sports. And, the more the better. Intramurals, the more the better on activity. But I really think that we want to keep in mind that all of the teachers, whether they're on a union or just coming to school, we're all one family wanting what's best for kids. And the big picture is that we're going to have more PE, and I think the board should look for that in the future. That would be my I would like to see that. But I think that it would be too abrupt, perhaps, to not approve the waiver this year.
Well, wow, Adrian, I'm stunned. I'm easily stunned. I support the waiver because it's part, there's a thing in the law about where you agree to do something and there are ancillary details that you have to sell CTA in their membership. Got some things to figure out, but I support the waiver. I also would like to acknowledge Mrs. Sheffer's excellent letter in which she made the point that it is simplistic to think that our PE waiver issue is going to cure obesity in our high school students. So let's keep in context what we're talking about. I support the waiver. I support the teachers' rights and the site-based administration of SLO High to implement the trimester system, and I believe this is a reasonable accommodation to effectuate that outcome.
Is there anybody else? Mrs. Dickinson, and then we'll go for a vote.
There's this poster on the wall in my classroom. I wish I could quote it. I should after on the wall. I don't look at it. I look at the students. But something about, never underestimate the fact that a small group of people can change the world, a small group of committed people. In fact, that's the only way significant change has ever happened. And the people that influenced me the most were Mr. Morrow and Ms. Mendez with their passion for the health of young people. It was those two voices that I thought were very significant in helping me to realize how important this issue is.
Chris. Sorry.
Mr. Peter.
I picked up the mic. I think we've obviously spent a lot of time talking about this issue, and a lot of us have had individual correspondence and individual meetings with PE teachers and with other teachers from San Luis High and other teachers within the district, and certainly we've... I want to say thank you to everybody who's taken the time to correspond with us on this issue. I've learned a lot, in particular from speaking with the PE teachers, and I think we would all acknowledge up here the value and the importance of PE and good nutritional habits. And to me, a little bit later on tonight, we're going to talk about the strategic plan. We're going to talk about the discretionary money that we allocate towards what we believe are the most important issues facing this district. And at the top of that list is closing the achievement gap. And when you look at, if you stick around and look at what we're spending our money on and the importance that that has for us as a board, I believe, in the overall issues that we're trying to address within the district, and if you think that we would have to take money away from that, for example, to increase classes, PE classes, or additional PE courses, I don't think you would find a lot of support for that within the board up here. I think we would say we need to stay focused on the strategic plan. So, in other words, to fund additional PE courses, I think, at the high school, it would mean something else in the program would have to give. And that's what it really came down for me. I support the waiver as well. And what it came down for me, good PE, nutrition,
And I think it's reasonable to expect that to happen by that time as well. So I'm going to support the waiver.
I also spend a lot of time on this topic. And one of the things I found is I believe there's legislation that has that's coming down that is actually going to allow students to test out of PE. Do I have that right, Ed?
It's sort of the reverse of that, is that if you don't test out, then you may have a four-year requirement.
So if I understand it correctly, some of this issue is going to go away in the near future. So it was another reason why I'm also in favor of the waiver.
I just got a wise observer of school district issues ask about this particular agenda item. Isn't this an academic freedom issue? I throw that out there for whatever it's worth.
Dr. Allentine?
Did I hear academic freedom? at any rate, just to expand on something, and Mark shared an email with me earlier today. The proposal that would say that unless a student passes the physical fitness test, they would have to take 4 years of PE, that's sort of a negative way of saying you could test out of PE, as Mark described it. One of the difficulty that's being faced by this is that the legislation uses the term passing PE, and there is no passing score assigned to the physical fitness test. It's simply a report of results. So at some point in time, someone would have to determine what passing was before we'd have a picture of how many students would be affected.
I think that would probably be a lot less binge drinking is they're going to...
Okay. Anybody else? Okay. I'd entertain a motion.
I'll move approval of item 12.
Okay. It's been moved by Mr. Millar and
seconded
by Mr. Peter. All in favor?
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Carries 6-0. Item number 14, and that was Mr. Spadafore.
The only reason I had that pulled is there was a donation made to San Luis Obispo High School for the Tiger Plaza project. Two things I wanted to mention. People will hear more about this, and I think Will Jones, the principal at San Luis High, is going to be number 14.
Okay. Do I hear a second?
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Peter. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Carries 6-0. Okay, let's move back in time to item number 2. Let's status of state budget. Item number 1 is reports by school staff and student representatives. We don't have our student representatives here. Is there any school staff member that would like to make a report this evening? Okay, seeing no one, then let's move on to item number 2, which is status of the state budget. Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Mr. President. Do have a couple of items that are starting to surface and gain some form in at the state level these days. Primarily, the big issue of conversation is Proposition 98 and its over-allocation in this particular year. You may have read that the Department of Finance overestimated revenues at the state level, and the net number of the multiple sources of revenues, corporation taxes are up, but personal income taxes are way down, and the net number is $1.2 billion of overestimated revenues last January when they presented the governor's budget. So we are over-allocated because we were allocated on that erroneous estimate, and it amounts to about $600+ million, and the conversation is about what happens to that money. In the past, as Mr. Sousa was talking about, the governor 3-4 years ago took back the overallocation in the middle of the year after we'd already budgeted and spent much of our money. That's not going to happen this year. That's almost certain. But the question remains, what will happen to that $600 million? The legislative analyst is recommending a return of the money to the state coffers, because to overallocate Prop 98 establishes a new floor from which it would then work.
Nice.
And then your question is, where do they take it from? And almost certainly it'll have to be in those one-time ongoing allocations, such as counselors, VAPA, any kind of program they gave us this year is in dire jeopardy for next year. So we need to be aware. We need to watch carefully. It is almost probable, if not certain, that there will be a campaign to inform the governor and the legislature that Prop 98 isn't a floor. It isn't a ceiling. It's a suggestion, requirement, that the minimum age for kindergarten is advanced from a birth date of December and reversed back to September. That will prevent, if you will, a large number of children from going to kindergarten as they would expect to go. In addition to that, the pre-K program is a program that has with it immense, tremendous costs, absolutely unbelievable costs related not only to personnel but to facilities. And you can liken it to the class size reduction program of 10 years ago in terms of the effect it would have on our facilities. We would be required to house preschools and incorporate within the Prop 98 allocation. And it's got a estimate, latest number is $2 billion. And the cost of just the Prop 98 piece, not counting the facilities piece. Preschool-age children carry with them their own requirements for housing and programmatic and class size and all of those issues. So watch that carefully because it has a lot of righteousness behind it. It's a great program in terms of educating children, but how are they going to fund it? It is a great idea without a very good funding model attached to it. So we'll be careful about watching that. Special ed. Special ed's ramping itself up at the state level. One of the came back from a convention, if you will, of chief business officials, and almost universally the number one issue that they want to talk about is the escalating cost of special education and the effect on all programs within a district. It is a litigious arena that has multi-million dollar fees going to attorneys. It has tremendous costs attached with major emphasis upon consultants and outside the educational district's arena for delivery of program. It is starting to become a big concern on how we're going to fund the future of special education based upon the reduction of the federal piece. They promised to do 40% of special ed costs, and I think it was 18% this past year. We look for special ed to be a big issue. Mandated costs are starting to resolve themselves in the district's favor. We have a new state controller who has a positive outlook on how the state ought to be treating its obligation to districts on mandated costs. We look for some easing of the onerous audit process that they were engaged in trying to get monies back from districts. So we do have $1.5 million in reserve of mandated costs received but threatened by previous practices from the state controller's office. It's not yet a recommendation from staff to release that money for use, but to retain it in reserve because we don't have any definitive outcomes yet, but we're looking better and better every day with the new state controller. Equalization is a big issue for non-basic aid districts. Just look for some money to be placed in the revenue limits of low revenue limit districts. If we were revenue limit, we would be a low revenue limit district. So if you look at equalization as a positive, should it ever happen to us, after we got out of intensive care, the increased revenue limit would be a good thing. I think that's about it.
Well, the $600 million overestimate, is that likely to come back at the basic aid districts in some form of equalization push? They can't take our basic aid anymore, but...
good question. And in the past, they did deficit the revenue limits of revenue limit districts, and then we had to give up categorical programs to have our fair share of the pain. It's felt almost universally that they'll take back some of the categorical programs that they were so generous with in January. The governor's got himself in a very peculiar position because he has already stated 2008 is the year of education. And the adequacy study that's been released and the political implications on all of those issues, he's made the statement 2008's the year of education. So he's going to be between the rock and the hard spot when it comes time to manage his state budget versus his political promises to the people of California. It's an interesting issue.
Maybe 2008 will come early. He'll have to deal with it in 2007. Then my only other question is, why is the shift of the attendance birth date for kindergarten, why is that not?
You wouldn't be moving anybody. You'd have the same universe of students. You just have less students in kindergarten and more students in preschool for a while.
And before John, I would think that what you're saying is true. If they were considering it a constitutional issue, then it's not a mandated cost, is my understanding. So,
Russell, just a quick question. California's always had a problem with funding because the sources are tied up in Prop 13 and historical limitations, and the revenue side always fluctuates, and that's what you're discussing tonight because of the personal income taxes dropped more than they had figured.
Correct.
Although every year his analyst and the legislative analyst never agree on what they believe will be the revenue. The governor evidently is trying to pass legislation to increase the number of slot machines in Indian casinos to make up the difference. And my question or my concern is, from our perspective in our school district, and I know other districts that share our funding source are looking at this continually, is there something that we need to do anticipating that there may not be additional funding sources because people are opposing the governor's effort to raise revenue from the casinos, to anticipate that next year and the year after, 2 years, may not be what we're expecting in terms of increases or revenue?
Does your question revolve around what can we do in order to mitigate the effects? Or
what should we do in preparation more than we're doing, if there is any?
No. You know, one of the strategies that San Luis Coastal has always, has had for a number of years now, two or three, has been that our programs are available for budgetary issues should a crisis arise for us. We've adopted the stance that Dr. Valentine iterated that our reserves don't need to be huge if we spend them on programs that we could cut if we needed to. I think we have those kinds of programs that are choices for the board to make about where their priorities are. We need to attack the idea at the state level before we start cutting our own programs. We were very successful on a grassroots campaign to save our basic aid status when they were threatening our local property taxes, taking them away. And what is discussed is some form of letter writing and conversation and bus rides to the Capitol, those kinds of activists most people are envisioning. But I wouldn't recommend that we prepare to or that we even start the process just yet. Let's see what he has to say in May. The May revise comes out. That's when he's going to reveal what his intent is for that $600,000 and the next coming year.
I would also point out that there is a Senate bill, and I forget if it's Senate Bill 650 or 850, that at least in its summary purports to address the bifurcation of the special education funding. And I know that CSBA, I believe, is tracking that bill right now. And I would just remind the rest of the board members that the CSBA Legislative Action Conference is, I believe, March 20th. And Elizabeth Hill will be the Monday morning speaker, and she's always really interesting to go here. I'm sorry, May 20th. Thank you. And so, if that's something that's of interest to board members, I would invite you to talk to Dr. Valentine and get your reservations in so that you can also not only hear about what's going on in the state, but also get a chance to talk to the legislators about your feelings and about things that you should think should happen in California.
Shall we move on to item number three then? Item number three is the resolution 120607, an authorization for year-end transfers. Again, Mr. Miller.
Thank you. This is an annual event for us at the end of the year so that we can close our books. One of the requirements is, and you do this in the first and second interims and at year-end actuals, you're giving us approvals prior to, because we don't have time at the time that we're approving our unaudited actuals, to make transfers within different programs and within different expenditure accounts. This is something we have time for in the middle of the year. We don't have time for at the end of the year. So you have a tradition, if you will. This is an annual event, an annual request, and we would respectfully request that you approve resolution 120607 for that purpose.
Move approval of resolution 120607, authorization for year-end transfer.
It's been moved by Mr. Millar and seconded by Mr. Spadafore. Any discussion? Seeing none, Mrs. Holmes.
Mr. Millar?
Aye.
Mr. Spadafore?
Yes.
Mr. Peter?
Aye.
Mrs. Dickinson?
Yes.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Mr. Buckman? Passed 6-0.
Okay. Let's move on then to item number four. Item number four is a strategic plan progress report. Dr. Matakovich.
I'm not opening my textbook, somebody tells me. I've been through this before.
We just made sure they weren't edible for Russell.
Thank you, Mr. Unger. It's a privilege tonight to come before you and speak to the strategic plan to give you an update on the progress that we've made this year. You've authorized major funding this school year to support the goals of the strategic plan. And as Mr. Peters mentioned earlier, the focus of the plan is to close the achievement gap. Our plan has objectives that are included with this item, and we provided in detail a written report for you on all the major funded programs. I'd like to thank the principals and their staffs for the work that they've done this year in these targeted areas. Assisting tonight with the presentation, I'd like to acknowledge the work of Jackie Kurt Martinez in special ed, Cynthia Ravelin in special ed, Damian Barnett in instructional services, Greg Halfman in adult education, Mary Zerm in reading recovery. And once again, I'd like to reiterate that what makes this happen are the principals and staffs in our schools. Included in this board item is the detail of the budget, so you have that as a reference, the funding that you have provided for each of the items. Our focus is on the work that has been done. We want to remind you that, you know, way back when you established the strategic plan, you looked at our profile of our students and their achievement. We are district. Damien's going to help me along with this. Disadvantaged students. You know that we're a district with declining enrollment. You also realize that we're increasing our population, our English learner population. Our students with disabilities continue to maintain the same level, but also we are finding that as compared to the overall population, these subgroups, our students with disabilities, our English learners, and our socioeconomic disadvantaged students, continue to have a performance gap, and that's why you targeted the resources the way you did to address these issues. We would like to walk through the main goals that we have addressing this achievement goal. And we provided you some blocks. And these blocks build on each other. What's very important to us is that the resources that you provided address the core needs of the organization. So I would like to begin with the first block that has to do with closing the achievement gap in general. So reading recovery is core. And you have provided quite a bit of resources and support to this program. We have now, we will have seen 126 students out of 440 students at the first grade level. And that is about 20 students more than we were able to see in our previous year. We have trained 17 teachers, and we've also educated 6 new reading recovery teachers in the process this year. Mary Zerm is here tonight, and she is almost a full-fledged teacher leader with her certification of the second year of her training, and we're very proud of what's been accomplished through our reading recovery program. We also have contributed, you also have contributed to the late bus after-school program. 6 of our elementary schools have participated in that program, and we have approximately 90 riders at this time for the after-school program. Our middle schools, too, have participated in the program, and so a total of 120 middle schoolers are taking the late bus home so they can participate in our after-school program. Professional development, Damien, if you would.
And I would just like to point out that reading recovery has recently been I believe, and I'm not sure of the terms, verified to be a highly effective
box. And in your materials, I provided substantial funds were invested in professional development, and there was definitely some question about how much professional development can an organization absorb in any given year. And I have to say we've done quite a bit and made some amazing goals. Professional development funds went to support reading recovery, as you mentioned, to help train teachers so that every first grade teacher who needs reading recovery could have it. It supported the benchmark process at the secondary level. And the work that went on there. It provided training for principals and school teams in both the professional learning communities and the response to intervention workshops that were supported in the county. We provided training in the area of writing in grades 4 through 9, provided ongoing training for EL specialists, provided cooperative education strategies for grades K through 3, provided training for special education staff, also an RTI, which is response to intervention in professional learning communities, PLC. It allowed us to do our physical education work, which has been a very large project and a focus for sure in the district, as well as the visual and performing arts work that went on with both district staff and community members as a whole. And those are just sort of the major portions of professional development, which you'll see throughout the different pieces. And I just wanted to take a second to sort of highlight those there. And there are many smaller pieces as well.
So we have our first block. So if you would place your block, and our next support core system has to do with our special ed population. So, Jackie, if you would, and Cynthia.
Good evening. With the first bullet, we have increased program quality and monitoring by acknowledging the student services coordinator. We've been able to work more closely with parents, work with staff, and enhance the programs. With support staff with release time aligns with goal number 7, and we've been able to support staff in with the certificated staff as well as the classified staff, supporting the high-impact students and the students requiring intensive services. We've been able to utilize supports in curriculum adaptations, team meetings, and collaboration. In the support, the year-long learning, with your support for establishing an extended school year coordinator, that aligns with goal number 9, and we're able to ensure program and IEP implementation with qualified, trained special education staff, and during the summer they were all. And then again, Damien has already spoken about professional development. I'll put my block on. And the next block.
Another key block that we've been talking about is closing the achievement gap for English learners. The strategic plan last year had laid out certain objectives, and one of those objectives was that every elementary English learner at level 1 and 2 would receive daily assistance from an EL specialist, and that happened through additional EL support that was approved by the board last year. Another objective was that secondary English learners...
I did have a question about that one.
Sure.
And first of all, I did have some questions, and I wanted to thank Dr. Valentine for responding to them. This one I wasn't sure about. We said that we directly serve 63% of the SELT level 1 and 2 students. What happened to the other 37%?
We support that the percentage there is the total number of K-6 level 1s and 2s that are in the district. The strategic plan last year called for direct support of grades 2 through 6. And if you look at that area of just grades 2 through 6, 82% of just grades 2 through 6 were served. The remaining 18% that wouldn't be made up there was looked at on a case-by-case basis by individual principals, and in some cases those were severely disabled students who required other services and in their day weren't able to work in EL specialists with the amount of EL specialists available at the site, or there were other conflicts in that situation. We also just need additional support as well in order to get that.
Okay. So
the 63% that's mentioned in the board item is looking at all ones and twos, kindergarten through sixth grade. So we have definite areas that we could extend down into kindergarten one to pick up those students if we had additional resources.
Thank you.
Also, I'd like to just acknowledge and thank Jillian Allen and Jennifer Kaufman, who are all EL specialists. And Jillian Allen is our English learner, teacher on special assignment. She's here, and she can answer specific questions as well. But I was mentioning also that one of the strategic planning objectives was that secondary English learners would participate in classes specifically designed for them. And the way we achieved that was, again, by additional EL support and providing additional EL sections at the secondary schools. This is the first year also that we're doing some formative assessments of English learners. Before, we had the SELT test, which is happens twice a year, and just the STAR results at the end, and now we've added another assessment called the ADEPT, which allows the English learner specialists to monitor the progress of their EL students on a much more regular basis. And then again, we've invested substantial professional development into the EL specialists as well as into their program. So you can add your blue block to the top of your program there. And I noticed that Mr. Buckman is doing it in a very creative way.
The fourth area that you've supported has to do with the economic disadvantaged students. And staff has chosen the AVID program to support our students across the board. We have 5 elementary schools who have implemented the program in the upper grades, 4th through 6th grade. Focuses on organization of materials and study skills and provides a common vocabulary for our students to work with their teachers on across grade levels. The other 5 elementary schools are interested in implementing the program in the new year and would commit to the summer workshop that will be happening in July and August. We have 3 secondary schools who are looking forward to implementing the program in the 7th grade and the 9th grade. They have established teams at their school sites and will be moving forward with implementing those classes. They're in the process right now of identifying the students who would qualify for these classes in the 7th grade and the 9th grade. There is an extensive professional development commitment with the AVID program. Besides the Summer Institute, it also involves ongoing meetings throughout the year. And I just need to say the elementary schools are very excited about their participation, and we look forward to this implementation with your support.
I have a question about that.
Yes.
I noticed Dr. Skoulis back there. I was at back to school night when you were giving the speech about the binder program and the kids were going to organize themselves and carry these binders around and portfolios and occasionally empty them out so that they weren't this fat at the end of the year. And How did that work out?
Hi, I'm Jim Skoulis, principal.
That overview of the focused support that you've given us, we see that the strategic plan has really emphasized student achievement and well-being. We're working on closing the achievement gap. We have our building blocks, which we've shared with you, the in-general support, special education, English learners, our socioeconomic students, and by putting a little lid on the top, a roof on the top, we have our little schoolhouse. So we just wanted to remind you about the core program that we have in our school district, and we want to thank you for that support, and we hope for continued involvement in these areas. So we look forward to some feedback on this item, or we'll await further questions. Thank you.
Well, just some general feedback. I was really happy to read this because last year, when I was a brand new board member, it's almost a year ago now, and I raised the issue about sort of having metrics that we could, you know, relate to when we reviewed these items. And this time through, there are metrics throughout the summary of each and every issue, and I think it was really helpful to have that. So thank you for doing that this time.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just wanted to comment pretty much the same as Dave. You know, for me, this really is finally the closing the loop. When we go through the strategic planning process, and I've been through some really terrible processes, not this one is excellent, and we build our budget and we do all of these things, and it's this feedback to us about what happened, that the programs, they were implemented. We assume they're implemented and that they're running well, but this is really ideal, and it just makes the budget process more responsive. It keeps in mind the guidance from the strategic plan. And I got to tell you, Dr. Valentine, I am so grateful for this strategic planning process. It's logical, comprehensible, and it actually is working. And I think it's, you know, your idea, and as the captain of the ship, you get the credit. But obviously, staff and at the district and at the sites bring it forward, and it makes budgeting a lot easier to deal with. And and Mr. Miller, let's not overlook Mr. Miller.
Yeah. I solicited the captain gets the credit.
Mary, just a quick question. Thank you, and I agree with Walt and David, and I also want to thank the staff because it's been very important for these groups of students to receive the additional assistance, and I think it's paying off. I had one question about the EL students from second to third grade. In the past, any change in the success ratio or the improvement?
You're correct in with that drop off, and actually, Mr. Mayfield's here, and I don't know if he wants to speak to that.
Do you know what I meant, Rick? About that?
I believe so.
Coming.
Yeah.
Yeah. There had been a drop off in the test results for the students EL going from the second to the third grade when the test was changed
right.
for them to
right.
their secondary language at that point.
The results that we have this year show that Pacheco EL students outscore the district from third grade all the way up through sixth grade on English language tests. So I wouldn't really be able to speak to long-term trends of test scores in the past, but what I've looked at this year show that the EL students outscore the district average on English tests.
So you're seeing that as being
a result.
And then how about the families in terms of the EL families? Has there been a change, or have you seen progress made in the language assistance to the parents?
I have, yeah. One of the things we're noticing now is that as some of these EL families bring new kids in, with especially ones with older siblings, that a lot of those kids have a high level of English coming in. So we're kind of at Pacheco especially confused as to exactly what language to put them in to start off with. In some cases, their English skills are stronger mm-hmm. than their Spanish skills. So it's a question we have to take them on an individual basis before
we make
that.
It's good to hear, because there was that article last week about the senior down at Royal Grande whose parents came from Mexico, and he's going to Harvard or Yale, where he was accepted because of his grades, and he came from a monolingual family. So if you look at the end result, all the effort that's put into this that's happening at our level, which has been right. so tremendous, it's important. And you can see in the families how important it was for them and how proud they were of their son at that point.
Right.
So thanks.
It's one of the frustrating issues, though, that we have to deal with is the fact that the children are educated in Spanish, and there are very, very good pedagogical reasons for that, but they're tested in English, and we're judged on those results, and it's just kind of an ongoing struggle that we have.
Okay, thanks very
sure.
much.
For that.
And, you know, I was going to save this for the next item, but I'll bring it up right now. In Saturday's Los Angeles Times, there was an article with the headline, Brewer Pledges Swift Action After Harsh Report on LAUSD. One of David Brewer's, who's the new superintendent, not so new anymore, of Los Angeles School District, one of his first actions was to require an independent audit of the school district. And the results of it were less than stellar for Los Angeles. Several of the things. The other one I think is more germane to this evening's discussion, and that was their finding in Los Angeles that there is no linkage between planning and budgeting. Consequently, there's little evidence that fiscal resources are being directed to support district goals. And what a shock for the people in Los Angeles to read these things and to find out that their school district is not aligning their budget planning with their district-supported goals. And I think that's something that we should be proud of when we look at our strategic plan and the linkage that we have between our budget process and our goals. I think that's something that we need to pat ourselves on the back with, and especially Dr. Valentine, who really made sure that this process happened. Are there other discussion on item number 5? Okay, let's move on then to item number 6. Let's move on to item number 5, which is the superintendent's 2007-2008 budget recommendations. Dr. Valentine.
Excuse me, I'll take just a second to set up here if I might. Whatever the board's pleasure is, I'm pretty quick.
Take a break.
I have self-interest in the back.
There's nearly $1.6 million of ongoing money and nearly $1 million of one-time money prioritized in the recommendation. The ongoing dollars are divided into four tiers of approximately $400,000 each. Russell Miller has shared in past meetings with the board a budget picture which makes it unlikely that we will be able to fund more than Tier 1 of ongoing money, if that. And we actually have greater confidence that the one-time monies will be available. The board has given staff direction to focus our energy on closing the achievement gap, the seemingly perpetual difference in achievement between advantaged and disadvantaged students. Our focus has been on socioeconomically disadvantaged students, English learners, and students with disabilities. The good news statewide and in San Luis Coastal is that students in those groups are making improvements. The equally good news is that all students are making improvements. And if there's any bad news in this, it's that the net gap between the two remains. Mary, could I take a look at that first chart? The chart on the screen shows the Academic Performance Index, or API, for all schools in the state in deciles 1 through 10. Low-performing schools has been a fairly steady stair step of progress, actually steeper than the progress of high-performing schools. San Luis Coastal has a number of high-performing schools. Of the 14 which receive APIs in our district, 3 are decile 10 and 5 are decile 9. Such rankings, however, can be as much a ranking of the concentration of educational challenges in the system, socioeconomically disadvantaged students, English learners, students with disabilities, as it is a ranking of the academic program. In fact, San Luis Coastal is labeled as a No Child Left Behind program improvement district for not meeting the achievement target for English learners. And I want to talk about that as we look at the budget recommendation. The board has the entire recommendation in tonight's backup, and rather than talk about each piece of the recommendation, I'd like to focus on some key elements, both in the one-time recommendation and the Tier 1 of the ongoing recommendation, then open the discussion up for anything the board wishes. Mary, could I shift? In the context of closing the achievement gap, I'd like to draw the board's attention to the one-time recommendation and to Pacheco Elementary School in particular. I'm going to spend a little more time on this one than on the other three or four items, which I'll feature very briefly after that. The short story is that Pacheco Elementary offers a dual immersion program in which students develop essential literacy skills in their primary language in the early grades while receiving all other instruction in both English and Spanish. In the middle and upper grades, students transfer their literacy skills to their second language, and Spanish speakers learn English language arts at an academic level, and English speakers learn Spanish language arts at an academic level. Pacheco has benefited from a $250,000 a year Title VII grant. The grant was for 4 years, but they budgeted the dollars out over 5 years, and those dollars have run out. They're applying for a foreign language grant, which, if successful, would provide $150,000 per year for 3 years. We believe Pacheco needs to continue and will require additional support to carry out its mission. It's a fabulous opportunity for English-speaking students to learn Spanish, but more importantly, it is the most powerful approach we have for transitioning English learners to academic proficiency in English. Thinking is first learn to read, and then your reading skills will transfer to your second language. That's what the research says, but what about Pacheco? Mary, could I see the next slide, please? Nobody will deny the challenges of English learners anywhere in American public schools, even at Pacheco. But given that, how do the data look? We're looking at the percent of students who are proficient or advanced on the third grade English only language arts test. This is a measure of our English learners taking that test. This is the year before the major transition to English. You can see that Pacheco English learners are a little bit ahead of the district's English learners in general. Remember, they do receive their other instruction other than language arts in English, at least part of the time. I'm sorry. Pacheco is on the left, the district is in the middle, and the state is on the right. Thank you. I'm glad you pointed that out. Anyway, Pacheco's a little bit ahead of the district's English learners in general, but significantly behind the state achievement level for English learners. Remember, the other English learners in our district and in the state have been taught to read in English. Now, what happens by sixth grade? Same order, by the way, Pacheco, district, and state. You'll see that the district and state students are plateaued at levels comparable or even lower than they were as third graders. The Pacheco achievement levels are now triple those of the state and the other English learners in the district. NCLB will never respond favorably to this because Pacheco students tested in grades 2 through 4 and even 5 will lag behind others before showing the growth which comes with the transition. I need to note that not even the 6th grade scores meet the NCLB standard, although they are higher than any other scores in our district and way higher than the state's. From a budgetary standpoint, and that's what we're talking about, is putting budget and vision to work. From a budgetary standpoint, we believe the Pacheco dollars are dollars especially well spent for our strategic planning goals. Furthermore, we invest considerable dollars in other English learner programs in the district. But Pacheco serves 35% of the English learners at the elementary level. Were these students distributed to other sites, we would need to invest additional dollars in those sites without an expectation of similar results. We see the Pacheco investment as a, for me, would be Pacheco Elementary School. I'll be more brief with a few other notable items. On the one-time list, yes, thank you. On the one-time list, I want to point out the continuation of primary grade physical education and music programs. Those programs are currently funded with one-time money, and I did not recommend ongoing funding for the simple purpose of wanting to leave greater room in Tier 1 for other items more closely related to our strategic planning goals. In the context of this recommendation, it would be an annual decision on the board's part whether or not to move primary PE and music into the ongoing funding tiers or stay in the year-to-year funding model that it's currently in. Finally, looking at the one-time chart, I need to comment on professional development. Put simply, if we're to move forward with efforts to close the achievement gap for our most challenged learners, we will need to continue to change and refine instructional practices. We need to get better. Our dollar amount represents approximately 4 days of professional development per teacher, but it's not intended to be allocated by teacher, but rather by program need. Now, Mary, if we could go to the ongoing. Just a couple of items I want to talk about in the ongoing, and then we'll move forward. Last year, we anticipated no additional cost for reading recovery in order to maintain the current levels of service, and we were wrong. The board will recall that reading recovery focuses one-on-one attention on our most challenged first-grade readers. They receive 30 minutes of instruction per day for an average of 16 weeks, and the majority of students who receive this will catch up with their classmates and stay caught up. It is one of those programs for which data are abundant, but both locally and nationally. We serve about 125 first-grade students, or 38% of our students in this critical grade level. The program is taught voluntarily, and the additional costs are incurred through veteran teachers rotating out of the program, requiring training of new teachers, along with a larger and larger number of students being served after school, which requires additional compensation. Our interest in the budget recommendation is to put dollars where they produce for students, and particularly for challenged students. Hence, reading recovery. I should note also that part of the professional development budget mentioned earlier also goes to reading recovery. Very briefly, I'll draw the board's attention to funding for the elementary and secondary AVID programs. You recall groups were asked to modify, and both elementary and secondary principals took items off of the template budget to make room for this, and I agreed with their change. This proposal includes Morro Bay High School for this year and would propose in the following year to bring on San Luis High School. Finally, I want to note the proposal for a program specialist for autism services. The board may have noted the article in today's Tribune regarding proposed program changes in Lucia Marr. All districts in the county are looking at options for providing services to growing numbers of students with autism. Some of those options involve providing services in district, which are currently provided by the County Office of Education, but funded by us. The placeholder in tonight's budget is predicated upon first finding an option whose combination of physical incentives and program advantages appeals to the board. I'll ask Russell Miller and Jackie Kirk Martinez, our Director of Student Services, to explain a little further.
Mary's going to help me with the slides. What I'd like to talk about is, yeah, I'm okay with this. Okay. The slides come up in order. So. Our program specialist piece has on its identifier an assumed no-cost item because it would come from savings. Savings would be predicated upon the successful completion of what has been a two-year ongoing discussion amongst all county schools, changing the special ed funding model that currently exists as a consolidated funding in the County Office of Ed that is supplemented by excess costs to a direct funding to the school districts paying the County Office of Ed for delivery or providing flexibility for the funding of our own programs or partnering with neighboring districts for that. But this program specialist assumes the successful completion of those discussions related to a new countywide funding model. Have to remember, it's proposed, it's in discussion, nothing has been finalized with that. Unit in order to cover your costs. Then the new AB 602 model came out and they gave you a per ADA amount to fund your special ed program. The one thing that's different today than was different when the AB 602 per ADA funding model came out is that there were very few autism identified students in special ed at that time. Autism has exploded. Under the new proposed language, benefits to the district would be that you could hire your own staff. The district would have flexibility to go with our own program or the County Office of Ed's program or partner with other districts. It creates greater efficiencies within the program. You can deal with changes, as we'll see here. Ensures program consistency and quality. Produces measurable data and outcomes. It allows for control of daily developments in a student's program and an ability to build capacity with non-public agencies in the training, delivery, and analysis of an individual educational program.
Is this envisioned to be delivered at individual sites or the home site for the student, or if we partner with another district,
What's different between the model that exists today and the model that's proposed by the 10 districts in the county is it would provide you with flexibility to do a number of things differently than what currently exists. Because you get your own money, you can create your own package. Gives you flexibility. You can do it within your district. You can do it within the County Office of Ed program. And most, quite frankly, most of the programs would probably remain at the County Office of Ed. And you can also partner, like with Lucia Marr, where they have a SDC class that has three kids, and we have six kids. Neither of those numbers provide for efficiency. We each have to hire our own teacher. We each have to hire our own facility, et there. Now we combo those kids together, and all of a sudden we're sharing costs on what are inefficient numbers, but delivering a quality program. So that would be an example. Next one, please. The potential savings are that the current model costs for all programs are funded from federal and state revenues. Any additional costs, our current costs of the autism program in 06-07, the County Office of Ed excess costs, it's an estimate because the year's not over yet, and we have some measurement that's done with current year pupils, and then some measurements are done with prior year pupils, but we estimate $350,000. We also have a non-public agency contract, $57,000. We have an additional autism supervisor of $5,000. Our essential cost for the autism program is $413,000. The cost for the autism program in the new model of 07-08 would be the CBED's portion of the excess costs. We'd have to pay for that for 1 year because of the current agreement causes us to be committed through 07-08 to that model, which would has a minimum charge of our CBEDs. We wouldn't have a usage charge. Remember that 50-50? Well, 50% of it we're not going to get charged for. There's no usage, but 50% of it is based on CBEDs.
That's just lingering overhead, right?
Yeah. That's the
way next year?
And then in 08-09, it would go away.
I'm aware that other districts are already not using the county office for supervision of in-district students. Why haven't we moved toward that model, and would a move toward that model reduce our costs anyway?
What we've done is we have used the County Office of Ed program for autism. Some districts, such as Pleasant Valley, has no kids in autism yet pays a CBEDS account. Okay, so they don't have the model. Paso Robles also is moving away from the county services, but still has to pay the CBEDS cost. We haven't moved away from that yet.
Right, but they're not paying for usage because they're not really using the county office programs.
That's correct. Uh-huh. But they are paying the CBEDS cost.
Okay.
Okay. So that's included in 07-08, and it's $157,000. Then the proposal for the budget is one program specialist, $86,000. If we had the program in our control, we would need five SCIAs at $140,000. And an NPA contract of $60,000. In 07-08, our total costs would be $463,000. We would have a net cost of $50,000 for 07-08. Mm-hmm. We've actually had conversation about this idea for over a year.
And the other thing, I'm personally curious. I understand the 602 procedures. I've been listening to those quite a bit. I think it would be appropriate to provide not only the positives, but I think there are some downsides and some risks to whatever the proposals are, and I would hope that those are presented to the board so that the board can make those kinds of decisions with all the information that would be necessary.
It's a good point. And what we are doing tonight is talking about budget issues, but the programmatic issues, which I think is probably a big
Well,
piece.
I think I'm talking programmatic and budget because okay. I think you can't disentwine those things when we're talking about special education.
Then that piece will come forward as this proposal, go ahead, go to the last slide. As this proposal gathers its final pieces together, and it's important to know, the new funding model is a proposed model that has been discussed and worked on for more than 2 years. It remains proposed until the countywide superintendents vote on it. I have up there May, but actually I've learned today that the proposed discussion and perhaps vote will be in June by the superintendents on a county basis. When that happens, then we know what we're talking about. Then we know what we're dealing with. Up until that time, they may choose to scrap the whole idea. They may choose to implement it without change, or they may have several or no changes, minimum changes within the proposal. I don't know exactly what to present to the board at this time until after. And we don't have any intention of presenting this for approvals or not. This is all about the program specialist and what it would look like under the new proposed funding model.
So if the proposed funding model isn't approved, is this off the table?
Not necessarily, because your idea is one we have talked about, is as you just stated, why haven't we gone to this in the past? As autism has evolved, and it has been an evolving process from the moment it became a program or a service, we might need to have that as a model we want to implement even under the current funding model. You remember when we had the coordinator position, part of our discussion was being able to have a defensible product, being able to take the legal issues and explain and defend them. That has worked very well, and I think we have seen that over the last year, and being able to put
autism and trying to build capacity within the different districts is a goal, along with the defensibility and quality control. So we are taking steps to move towards building capacity to try and get out in the forefront of the rise in autism. Mike Smith from Lozano Smith has said that the analysis that they're doing through Lozano Smith is what is all this litigation about? And it is the location of attorneys and advocates, as well as autism, the disability and services under autism. And they will be coming out with a letter, a statement through the state of California of looking at the rise in autism and the defensibility of those services.
Is that 101 and 150, that the whole children on the whole spectrum, counting Asperger's and everything?
Yes, it is.
Okay. I'm also going to be really curious on what our costs are going to be for the non-public agencies that are going to be assisting us. I know those can be quite costly, hundreds of thousands of dollars, as a matter of fact, and so I'd be really interested in finding out what kind of contract we're talking about, who we're talking about, and what kinds of programs they would be proposing in order to make it defensible, because I do believe that those can be costly programs and continue to increase in costs. And you know, and I'm also curious too about the relationships between the non-public agencies and various attorneys.
Sorry. Okay. That actually, both of those items have caused us to have numerous discussions, particularly the last one. What is the relationship between an attorney and an NPA, and is the advocate's attorney championing some particular NPA because that then gives entree into the district's program, and is there some legal issues that involved with that? It's a very serious consideration. There's no doubt that the NPA contract can be constructed as we see best, and we would ask for certain things and construct, but that's about building capacity. And as we get familiar and comfortable with the funding model, then we will be able to determine what kind of services we need from the NPA. I just want to reiterate one last thing, and that is Helen Hillen. Dr. Hillen was asked, is this plan going to be adopted? And he said, almost certainly. Not necessarily in its current form, but it will be adopted. So if we take that as where we're going, we need to start reacting, as Chris is talking about, in a certain way. But we need to be considerate of the idea that things might change on us. So let's be careful. Okay? Thank you.
I think that concludes our formal presentation. But I think the board may get a flavor of the kind of primacy of the issue of special education as a discussion topic in California education, and in fact in national education as well. And the issue of preparing oneself to deliver quality programs to students, which is part of our strategic plan, is part and parcel also of creating defendable programs which do not invite the frequent and deadly litigations that special education across the nation is struggling with now. It's really by providing quality education for special education students, it really is a measure of trying to find the best way to preserve dollars for all children in the educational system. Open up to any questions. We didn't hit nearly all of the items that are in the budget proposal.
Okay. I'd like to go through all the items, please.
Alphabetically.
Alphabetically. I have a short, quick question, Dr. Valentine.
Please.
On strategic plan tier one, the one we hope to get through, but we don't think we can get through.
Correct.
At this point, are these listed in any priority or order?
No, they aren't. Okay. And at whatever point it becomes clear that we can't get through them, we would have to do that.
And then on the one time, is that also true, not prioritized?
Correct. Correct. Although Pacheco is number one from the superintendent's recommendation on either list.
I heard that.
Okay.
I just wanted to check, in view of the $600 million over estimate, are the tier items and the one-time items that involve categorical funding, are we at a place where we know whether that funding is going to show up?
No. The vocalized answer is we don't know if the funding is going to show up yet.
Another year.
Yeah. Okay. Russ or Ed, either one, when will we know how much of the 400, if any, or if we have more, will be available for allocation?
Good question. And the straightforward answer to it is that sometime in mid-August, the assessor's office knows what our property tax revenues are going to be and communicates that.
And does that happen every year then in August?
It happens every year that they finalize the tax rolls and do the assessments, and it's all done, and we know what our property taxes are going to be. However, usually in May, mid-May, the county tax auditor has established some pretty solid numbers. And in the past, I've gone with those as good estimates. So I will tell you, I think we have a very good estimate in May. We will have very solid numbers in August.
So then what could happen is if the May-August numbers differ, we may have to pull things off the list for next
or
year.
Add or
potentially
back
we could dip into Category 2.
Yeah. If I could on that one, I think that at whatever point we commit to a Tier 1 and a one-time funding piece, I would ask the board to consider the advisability of following through with that for a year and using either reserve funds or funds set aside in the mandated cost reserve or something like that in order to bridge the amount of time that we have. There are staffing decisions that have to be made
that's what I was
prior to that.
If we begin this process now. And then when are we going to have the big picture budget review? That's scheduled, right? Is that going to happen?
Yeah, May 8th.
May 8th.
Because, again, last year we were just completing this process when I came onto the board, but there's this bucket of money that could be $1.6 million or $1 million, but is that each year the exercise this board goes through is allocation of that money based on your recommendations?
Well, this is the second annual iteration of that.
Okay. Because there's the big picture budget, too, where we may look at, you know, allocations from within those funds as well, correct?
Yes.
Potentially. Okay. So we'll have that when? May 8th, is that right?
May 8th is your review of our budget as it exists today and has it existed the last 2 years in a row.
Okay.
So we're going to do your comparisons with bar charts and some visuals and talk about what the budget has looked like. Okay, so that you get an idea of where we're spending the money from ongoing monies or from one-time revenues for a year based upon whatever the reality is in August. Because we can't wait till August. We have to do a budget adoption by June 30th. It's the law. They don't give us all the information we need, but we do the best we can.
The governor does, right?
Yeah.
Every year by June.
And Dr. Valentine's absolutely right. We can't even wait for the personnel decisions that are in embedded in some of these items. So if you guys agree to these, then we're going to implement them whether the funding originates or not.
Okay.
Oh,
hopefully tonight we're not supposed to give you feedback about this, right?
It's an ongoing conversation.
When are we going to do that?
Well, that, I think, is the timeline Russell was talking about, late May and early June.
And then we'll have another opportunity.
Yes.
Okay. Because we might want to say, yeah, I really think 100 computers is really important, and maybe we don't need a BITSA coordinator. Those teachers that quit, maybe weren't that good anyway. Do we have to have a BITSA coordinator? We
yeah.
have to. Okay.
Yeah.
See, those kind of things.
Any other discussion from the board? Anybody from the public that would like to talk about this item right now? Okay. Let us move on then. Thank you very much, everyone. Let's move on to item number 6, approval of proposed revisions to board policy 6161.11. Dr. Matakovich.
Thank you, President Unger. You requested that we bring the policy back to delineate the policy intent that you have relative to supplementary instructional materials. This is our second reading. In meeting with the principals to review the policy, it came to our collective understanding that a number of the statements in the policy really were procedural in nature. The principals asked for some time to spend developing ARs, so we had a good session relative to that, and we think by the end of May we should be able to have our ARs in place to be able to manage the policy. So what's presented here for your review and discussion?
I think that was good. It makes me a little uncomfortable, though, not to put in, not to respond to that idea that came out of the academic freedom study session of teachers being able to have more flexibility and autonomy on choosing materials, especially films and videos, that they could spontaneously bring in without going through a long process. So just to recognize that we did talk about that. You weren't here when Charlie Chaplin was brought up? Maybe that was the week before, but... Okay. Anyway, I like the first paragraph. I think it's great. And I would like to add, and you all have a copy of this, the board recognizes that teachers are professionals and places confidence in their ability to make sound judgments responsive to the needs of their students. And I think it's good to put that responsive part in, because part of being responsive is the ability to be flexible and kind of immediate. The board places confidence in administrators to communicate general guidelines and specific copyright regulations. Some teachers don't know it's against copyright regulations to show any film at school just for entertainment purposes. You can't show a Disney movie on the last day. It all has to be educational. The board places authority in administration to make a final decision regarding use of specific supplementary instructional materials as they work collaboratively with all parties should a conflict arise. And this addresses Dr. Valentine's concern that, you know, who does make the final call? And so it's going to be the administration. So I thought that just sort of made a very general guideline without any specifics. It doesn't say what the guidelines are, you know, any of this exactly. But it just documents the board's discussion about the teachers make choices, the administrators communicate the guidelines and specific copyright regulations within which those choices can be made, and make the final call if there's a discussion about it. So I would feel more comfortable with that added.
Other discussion? I'm in support of just adding paragraph 1, and I appreciate what you've said here, Adrian, but I'm not going to support that, as this is the authority in the administration to make the final decisions, that's going to be going in the ARs, and that recognizing teachers as professionals, I think that feels to me like that belongs somewhere else, and I don't know where we would do that.
Well, it sets up an expectation, for one thing. We expect the teachers to be professional
right.
in their choices, which is a concern that I know we want to address.
Yeah, like I say, I appreciate it, but I'm going to just support it as it is. So, would you like to make a motion, Adrian, with the AR or with the proposal with your addition, and then we can see if there's any other discussion and take a vote on that?
Well, I make a motion that we table this till we see the AR.
Yeah, what are you suggesting, that we table the whole
That we table the specific wording, or that we table whether we use just this one paragraph or not, since that's the action. Well, yes, we'd make a motion, so that's it.
Okay, so do we have a second? Okay, seeing none, would somebody else like to make a motion?
I'll make a motion that we approve the proposed revisions to Board Policy 6161.11 as they're drafted here.
Okay,
item
we have
number
a
six.
Motion and a second. Any other discussion? Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, it carries 5-1. All right, let's move on then to item number 7. Instructional materials adoption for new modified secondary courses. Mr. Barnett.
Thank you. Good evening. Again, what you have before you is just a list of instructional materials that have been evaluated. And the recommendation has been reviewed and discussed by staff from the administration, and it's presented to the board's consideration. Again, as the item on the AP history course, these materials are on review for the public until May 8th, 2007, here at the district office. And if anybody wants to come see them, they can. And so this was just for discussion, and we'll be back.
Any discussion on item number 7? It would be A, adjournment, and B, we would dispense with the NCLB, parts of the NCLB as written. I think it was the intent of the board to be educated on the various parts of NCLB, some of which, thanks to Mr. Buckman, were pointed out that may be detrimental to eliminate others, which we all agree seem to be designed to penalize school districts no matter what by 2014, and basically, from my perspective, eliminate public education in the United States. So given that, my personal interest is, can we have a presentation on the various parts of NCLB? I know that there is a move afoot, again, which we approved last meeting, to support the movement to change NCLB. So if we could look at that, that would be my interest, and what the Act itself really consists of in its various parts. Is that kind of would that be the pleasure of the board, Mrs. Dickinson?
I think that sounds good. I wanted to say that I did a little research on this just inadvertently. I was talking to a friend of mine in Montclair, Ontario School District, teaches third grade, and they do nothing but math and reading and writing in the whole school day. They have 15 minutes of actual STAR prep, and then 2.5 hours of reading where they have to have direct instruction, no library books or any other personal books. Only a Houghton Mifflin textbook is allowed. And it's not even taught according to Houghton Mifflin representatives. This reading first is laid down draconian ways that it can be taught. Teachers are cited if anyone has crayons out when she comes around to visit. Any art up for open house has to be done at recess or at home. There's no PE, no social studies, and no science. The library is, in fact, closed for the rest of the year. And she has a master's degree in education and now hates her job. And my sister, who was down, said it's not that different in her district. She teaches special education, so she has a little more flexibility, but they're only allowed to have one marker out during math. But it's so deprived that the effort to let the public and the government know at a federal level what the outcome actually is.
Okay. Anything else? Dr. Valentine?
Well, I wanted to make it clear that the kind of program that Mrs. Dickinson is describing was connected to some place other than San Luis Coastal.
That was the Torquemada Unified School District in Southern California. Charter Academy.
I will say, though, and I'm in agreement with it, I mean, as a school district, we are approaching the third year of program improvement based on the achievement of our English learners. And at least the consequences on paper for going into that third year, and I suspect we will be in that third year, are draconian, as Mrs. Dickinson said. And I'm going to have an opportunity next week, actually, to go and meet with folks from other districts in similar places. And part of the agenda is to provide an opportunity for us to provide input. And I'm hoping to share some of the data along the lines of what we shared about Pacheco to kind of look at what kind of improvements have taken place that NCLB would not recognize, plus to look at the overall achievement of our school district. And I'm hoping that those efforts will coordinate nicely, perhaps, with the interests of Mrs. Dickinson to communicate that. And with respect to whatever it takes or anything it takes, whatever it takes is a book by, is it Rick DeForest? Yeah, very excellent book that most people would be very proud to have associated with their school. Mr. DeForest was a principal of a school that was not a one-time National Blue Ribbon school, but four times in a row, a high school of 4,000 students. Chicago was where it was. Anyway, a fabulous description of thinking about education. It's not very, very restrictive at all. So anyway, No Child Left Behind, we're ready to share what it's about, and hopefully by then we'll know what the future looks like.
And I think for the board, from my perspective, and perhaps for the other board members, it would be interesting to see what actually the program improvement year 3 and 4 would look like. So if
I don't necessarily want to do it in an academic way, because I kind of know a lot of it already. And I don't know that I want the board to embark on a mission of informing the public about how screwed up No Child Left Behind is. I don't mind informing our public how it impacts our district, and particularly the Pacheco program. So, and I've got a concern. I don't sit here with the, you know, I feel like I have enough responsibilities trying to be a good board member and to help in the oversight of the district. I don't know that I have it in me to move beyond that to a broader responsibility to try to change the nation's view of No Child Left Behind and all that. That's my concern.
Sure.
By 2014, all schools will fail, including our schools. Just so we're tied in with everyone. It's not like we're separate.
Well, and I don't dispute any of that stuff.
Okay.
But I got to tell you, a system that all schools will fail by 2014 will fail before the schools fail. I guarantee it. I don't have a problem with the presentation. I do have a doubt that it... Not a doubt. I'm wondering if it's actually necessary. It almost sounds like Friday packet material, except for, you know, if the motivation is to get a public exposure to all this, then that's a different discussion. But if the idea is for us to get information from the administration about the impacts of No Child Left Behind, that's a Friday packet.
John?
An agenda item sounds fine.
Adrian?
Well, I thought one of the outcomes was going to be that we might do a letter or something with more specific recommendations to Congress.
Okay.
But we do have advocates like the Cal State School Boards Association that is actively working on that. I mean, they're back there lobbying right now. In fact, we got information about that yesterday.
Could we then start with just maybe a Friday packet on just some of the general outline of what No Child Left Behind is, a very general outline of just the specific pieces of it, because I think as we learned last week, we about what it what that act includes, and then I think probably, and not within the next probably month or two, because we're going to be pretty busy, but I think we do need to have a discussion or a presentation about what years 3 and years 4 are going to look like, because that is something the public is going to need to be aware of, from my perspective.
So everybody's shaking their heads. So that's the agenda item.
That's the agenda item, yeah. Okay. Shall we move on then to item number 21? Do we have any advanced agenda items? And I do have one, and I would like to just, from Mrs. Joyce, from the letters that the Joyces wrote to us, I would suggest that we discuss or that we have a presentation on the school, on school safety. I know we've talked about that before. I think that the tragic events in Virginia would require us to have that discussion for the public and let people know what we're doing to keep our schools safe. And I think that I would ask that that be more than just a Friday packet, that that be something that the public be made aware of as well, recognizing that that will happen on a school-by-school basis, but I think we need to hear about that too. So do I have some support from the other board members on this? Yeah, please.
Could we do it in the context of a presentation about our emergency plans and intervention systems that we have now, which we've actually exercised and used before?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
I think it's a good idea.
Mr. Peter?
Yeah, I'd be interested in bringing back, following up on the discussion we had a couple of weeks ago about the tech plan for the district, coming back to the issue of what the acceptable use policy is for teachers. I think we may, in my opinion, we may be being a little bit overly restrictive, and I'd at least love to bring the board policy back and look at it and see if we could loosen up the restrictions if there's interest in that. I'm talking about teachers, not students.
Could we start with a Friday packet on that and then take that forward and see what comes out of that in terms of a discussion?
That sounds good to me.
Does that look, Walter, work for you? Okay,
yeah.
Other things?
Anybody else? No, I was going to ask that the board calendar the self-evaluation process like we had last year and find an acceptable time and date and then discuss the utilization of a moderator. Like we had last year, but anyway.
Maybe you're right. That might be a little hard.
Yeah, it's got something on it.
Yeah, Dr. Allenton.
Yeah, I know that a number of you have been contacted by the Sheer Edge folks who are doing the development project in Avila. Met with them this morning, and we think it would be probably a good idea to bring them here so that the board has a consistent message about what's going on with that project.
Yeah, of course.
Where was that meeting this morning? Because
it was in our office.
At 11?
Yeah, in fact, they left to go meet you.
I know.
No, it was at 9 in our office, but they left so they could go meet you at 11.
I was at their office at 11 and waited around until about 10 after, and there was nobody there, so I went home. And they called me and asked me if I was still coming to the meeting, so that's why I was curious. But yeah.
Well, they used you to get out of our meeting and then didn't have yours. So.
And I'm glad you're protecting me from one.
This sounds like...
I was at 11 o'clock. I know. I got out of my doctor's appointment early, didn't have anything to do.
You know, I would...
I got it.
As always, and we could not address Mrs. Norris's concerns, I think that I would ask that that you report back to the board on that, if you would, please. Thank you.
And then I didn't know, was there an agreement on the board to schedule the board self-evaluation. I didn't. I missed that.
I think except for Walter.
Who I like the self-evaluation.
Yeah.
So we'd ask the administration to help us in scheduling that at a mutually convenient time, place like it was last year or something. Okay. And now the final thing is, and this is something that I may not explain clearly, but I want the board to consider this and then just get feedback right now. I was thinking that one thing that isn't available to the board is an opportunity to interact with the graduating seniors from our three high schools. And we make so many decisions about the students, and very rarely do we get an opportunity to actually talk to them. So this is an idea, and there needs to be no comment tonight because I'm afraid of what the comments would be. But down the road, if this is something that everybody has a sense that might work, I was thinking of an afternoon where the board would host the seniors from the three high schools. We could pick a place here or Cuesta or somewhere in the middle. And it would be called something like a glance back and a vision towards the future or something similar. And I think at that point, if it makes sense, the board maybe would recognize a student from each high school, maybe a vision and education award, something to recognize, something along the lines of what our goal is and what our direction is, maybe a teacher from each school, and then maybe an administrator. But I'm mostly concerned with the idea down the road about the board having an opportunity to interact with the seniors as we get to that point.
And I'm going to take you up on your offer of having this discussion maybe at the next time because it's getting kind of late.
One quick thing.
Yes.
Does Russell want to draft a letter for us to do a political action letter to the governor about that issue that you raised?
Which one?
About the $600 million. Mm-hmm. You said put pressure on, hey.
Sure. Mm-hmm. About the $600 million.
Then we could all sign it or something. Okay.
All right. Shall we move on to item number 22, which is just things from board members? Anybody got anything? Okay.
I'm holding myself.
Well, I just want to say I participated in a CSBA webinar, which was kind of cool, on government relations. And I am the government relations chair for this area for Sam Blakeslee. And I will be contacting Sam about issues related to schools and governance and things like that. So I look forward to that. Anything else?
Yeah, Saturday is Impeach Day.
Is what?
So that's a government relation.
Is what day? Oh. And don't forget, it's school open house. It's school open house season, everybody. Morro Bay High School tomorrow night. All right, thanks, everybody. Anybody want to adjourn us?
Move for adjournment.
Let's go. Thank you very much.
Good night, gang.